Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
They called him Machete.
As you may know, illegal aliens such as yourself are being forced out of our country at an alarming rate for the good of both our people. Our new senator must die, and for that I will pay you $150,000. Cash.
He was given an offer he couldn't refuse.
I'd cost the most, because I'm the best there is.
Set up, double-crossed, and left for dead. He knows the score.
Where are my wife and daughter?
He gets the women. And he kills the bad guys.
They're coming after us.
They just f*** with the wrong Mexican. Action. Suspense. Emotion.
Please, Father, have mercy.
God has mercy. I don't.
If you're gonna hire Machete to kill the bad guy, you better make damn sure the bad guy isn't you. Machete. Rated X.
It is 19 minutes after the hour of one, and this is the month of September in the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming along, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, America's new home for quality. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It is Thursday. Thank you for coming on by. It's 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. If you'd like to be part of today's program, telephonically speaking. There you go. What better way to start the program than Machete? Would you say you opened ham-fisted radio with that yesterday?
I did indeed.
Awesome. Well, it's in the air.
It is.
How can you not use it? Here's the best and worst thing about that Machete trailer with Danny Trejo is that I remember when that first was in, well, when it was in the Grindhouse movie, which was like a year and a half ago or something like that. It was like Bobby, the fat boy, and I, for like a week and a half afterward, everything we said was just said in that announcer voice. And it was just like when you were doing nothing in particular, you know, you'd be like in the kitchen making, he eats the bagel. It didn't matter what I was, you know, it didn't matter what I was doing or what activity I was involved in, I had to say everything like the announcer guy from Machete. He starts the program, he plays the music, he gives the intro. Because that's one of like three voices in this world that I can do sort of passably well. I should just rent myself out as that guy, you know, as a guy who sounds like the Machete trailer guy.
Yeah,
sort of because I can't really, you know.
But really, is that guy that expensive?
I don't know. I mean, who knows? Machete might really put him on the map. It's not like my Hank Hill impression's really going to get me any work. So, I mean,
your Professor Farnsworth impression is quite good.
I see, but that's only when he says the good news, everyone. That's, you know, I can do the good news, everyone. You know, but then it all falls. Like, if you were to ask me to say anything else in that voice, I can't really do it. And as I think we found out during the whole Leverage audition process, my bad Ricardo Montalban is in demand by no one. He fails the audition. He mangles the accent. He's Rick Emerson. All right. In any event, it is 503-505-6964. Big news coming up here in just a moment. We have a actually, two special guests. So we have coming up on Monday. This is very complicated, but it's actually not that complicated. So we have a special guest Friday afternoon. which is tomorrow, today being Thursday the 2nd. Tomorrow afternoon, Friday the 3rd, we got a special guest. Going to be a little bit later in the day than we typically do our interviews. You know, usually the show goes from like 1:15 to, you know, 3-ish, whatever. Tomorrow afternoon, we have a special guest, and we're going to be doing the interview live right here on the show. So we're going to do a sort of supplemental installment of the show tomorrow afternoon. We will then play the interview back next week. So that's a long way of saying the interview is going to air next week. But if you want to tune in tomorrow when we're actually doing it live, I'll put a thing up on Twitter about it. It's going to be a little bit later in the day. That will be Mr. Dave Mustaine from Megadeth.
Dave Mustaine?
Dave Mustaine.
The Dave Mustaine?
The Dave Mustaine. The Steve Jobs of the metal world. So he'll be joining us on the Rick Emerson Show tomorrow. A special. So tomorrow, so nobody's confused about this. Tomorrow we do the regular show. I'm coming and do all of it. You rolling your eyes?
No, I'm trying to keep track of what you're doing. I'm doing that thing where
you're mocking my attempt at specificity here.
No, I'm doing the thing where I look up at the ceiling so that I can burn all of this into my memory.
All right.
I'm doing that. Okay. Come into the studio. That's what I'm doing. Yeah.
The train leaves Philadelphia with Dave Mustaine on it at 6 p.m.
Exactly.
All right.
That's what I'm doing.
And if Kerry King is in a Gulfstream and he is flying west against prevailing winds from the south. So, the show airs, you know, this regular show airs from like 1:15 to 3, so we'll do all our regular stuff tomorrow. Then, you know, high tea, and then I will come back tomorrow. And tomorrow, you don't have to remember all this because I'm putting it up on Facebook. I'm going to say tomorrow, Friday afternoon.
Is there really going to be high tea?
Yeah, there will for me anyway.
The sandwiches and
if you would like
scones. Lemon curd.
And a variety of biscuits. And then tomorrow afternoon around 4:45, 5 o'clock, something like that, we will have our interview with Dave Mustaine. So that'll be happening tomorrow afternoon. I don't know where the... hold on, that was not me, actually. I've completely lost my sound there.
You lost your crazy busy opening sound.
I have...
Whatever it is you think of that as.
Normally that's because I've kicked out a cord somewhere. There we go. All right. That wasn't...
You know what would be awesome is if we could actually have Dave Mustaine in here live and have high tea with him.
You know, here's the thing about Dave Mustaine.
I bet he loves tea.
Dave Mustaine is a sophisticate in ways that you might not imagine or anticipate. So he really is. Here's the thing about it.
He might enjoy some finger sandwiches.
I'm going to say this right now. When I interview Dave Mustaine tomorrow, that's me, Rick Emerson, interviewing Dave Mustaine right here on the Rick Emerson Show. When he does the interview with Dave Mustaine, I don't get starstruck very easily. You know, and that's not because I'm old. You know, it's not because I'm like such a hip styling individual who functions at the very top of American social hierarchies. It's just that I think that I had to sort of like get past that, or I had to forcibly move beyond getting starstruck or getting weirded out in the presence of you know, people of any sort of note, because otherwise it just makes it impossible to interview them. And you're probably the same way. I mean, where you just sort of have to detach yourself from the fact that you are sitting in a room with like whoever, because otherwise you just couldn't function. You couldn't get anything done.
Well, I've never really suffered from the starstruck thing for some reason. It's been something that's bothered me. Maybe. I can't even say it's because I grew up in the Los Angeles area, because I had friends who, like, I was at the mall once and someone was like, "Oh my God, that's Jeff Bridges." And I was like, "Okay, he's in the bookstore buying a book." And they're, "Go get his autograph for me." I was like, "No, he's buying a book. Leave the man alone." I've never been weird about celebrities, but when I do an interview with someone who is like famous or do a director or a musician or something, I get like performance anxiety.
Yeah.
And I never get performance anxiety about anything else, but when I have to do an interview, I just all of a sudden it's like, "Oh God, what if the tape recorder doesn't work and I'll say something stupid?" And I just start getting sick to my stomach. And then I have to kind of get past that and not let any of that show when I'm actually doing it.
And they say, "By God, that Dawn Taylor was calm, cool, and collected." What a professional interviewer she is.
They never know.
Do you get that thing sometimes? We'll get back on track here in a moment. And we'll talk more about how Rick Emerson, will be interviewing Dave Mustaine tomorrow. And then Monday, Terry Brooks. Sci-fi fantasy author Terry Brooks. So it's just, it's a good week to be us. And you, humble listener, a good week to be you as well, as is every week in which you may listen to the Rick Emerson program.
You should tell people you know who do not currently subscribe what they're missing by not subscribing. They will not get to hear Dave Mustaine and Terry Brooks.
And then just kind of spit at their feet and walk away. Just sort of inform them of all the glory that they're missing, and then just sort of give them a dirty look, and then just kind of go right at the ground, and then shake your head sadly and make one, you know, like a last bit of lingering eye contact, and then kind of curl your upper lip and then stomp off in the other direction.
Yeah.
Do it all in exactly that order. That will have entirely the effect that we're looking for. But do you get the thing when you're interviewing somebody about, you know, you say you have performance anxiety, you're interviewing somebody who is famous or notable in some way, and you want to make sure you don't screw it up, where the interview itself is kind of like a blur, where you remember sort of walking into the room or starting the phone call or whatever, and then the next thing you know, you remember hanging up, and you don't really remember the actual interview. I mean, you know you did it. You know it happened at some point, but it's all kind of just lost in the ether of your mind.
Kind of, yeah. Although I can't let that happen, though, because I've had two notable situations where my recording devices failed on me.
Oh.
And then I had to, like, reconstruct as much of the interview as I could from memory.
Oh, that sucks.
Afterwards.
That sucks. And it sucks so much, I'm actually going to make you relive one of those moments here in just a second so that I can feel your pain vicariously and drink your sweet, salty wine-like tears. Coming up today, Snuff Watch, Penis Watch, Monkey Watch coming up later on the day as well. Anna Griffin from the Oregonian will be here. Here's the thing that she was writing about. She had this thing in the paper about the quote, voter-owned elections, end quote. And I have no idea what that is. And it's one of those things that I feel like I ought to understand. It's one of those phrases you hear all the time, and I have I just sort of, you know, when I read the paper, my eyes kind of go over that and they linger for a second and they just sort of slip off like Teflon because I don't know anything about it.
Do we have voter-owned elections? Is that what they're saying?
Apparently.
Because we do the vote by mail and we aren't beholden to the
but is that what that
the
means?
Companies that own the voting machines
but
or
is
something?
That, but is that what that even means?
I don't know. I have no idea what that means.
Yeah, see me either. All right. And she's also, she wrote about the restoration of the Hung Far Low sign. So we'll talk about that here in just a bit. So Anna Griffin from the Oregonian will join us. We got today's top five. Today's top five, and this is by request. Somebody requested a top five that was somehow debut album oriented. And I don't actually know who it was. You passed that along to me.
Yeah, it was someone in the text box.
Somebody had requested that we do a top five that was in some way centered around debut records. So we're going to do the top five first songs from a first side of a first album. So, you know, you put on the record, the CD or whatever, it's the very first song on the album, and it's the debut album. So again, first song, first side, first album. That is today's top five. We'll get to that. Plus, Dawn Taylor is tracking the following headlines on your Thursday.
The Vancouver woman who was hit in the face with acid was indeed hit in the face with acid.
It wasn't an acid-like substance.
No, it was apparently actually acid.
Okay, I'm sure that's a distinction that matters to her, by the way.
Salmon are making a comeback. And an extra on Transformers 3 was injured during a shoot.
All right. It is 503-505-6964 if you would like to engage with us via the telephone with your comments, questions, queries, comments, amusing observations of an ironic nature, whatever it is you might have. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. And Dawn can be reached. It's Dawn, D-A-W-N, D-A-W-N. At rickemerson.com. And I got some email and whatnot to get to, including one about the quest for the chocolate peanut butter bugles, which is, I guess, a thing that has started to consume some small section of the audience who have now started devoting sections of their day every afternoon searching for them because apparently it's a niche product that is only available in certain neighborhoods. It's like the reverse of the Viso in the bottle, which I guess you can now only get. I think they're moving westward or moving eastward from the west. They're doing a thing where it's in one, it's there, then it's going to be here. I guess the Viso is on the west side of town, is my point, in the bottle.
Ah.
The chocolate bugles, on the other hand, because this is nature's way of distributing favors, that is only on the east side. And so I got some people who are trying to track that down. So I'll go through a variety of those emails later on because they just... I got an email from somebody last night. I got three in one evening. And it was just sort of written in this frantic, ill-hidden, desperate sort of all caps kind of a tone where somebody was demanding to know where I had purchased them. I got the feeling it was a matter of, like, it was seemed like it was considerable importance. And I don't want to say that they were stoned, but it did very much have the sort of,
well,
like somebody had been sitting around, experimenting with some of nature's more interesting output, and that they suddenly got it into their head that they had to have the chocolate peanut butter bugles, and like everything had to stop, like life had to grind to a halt until that was taken care of. So that was pretty much my evening last night. Dawn Taylor, your evening?
Well, I had one of those evenings. I started out with straightening up my fridge and freezer because it's the end of the week and it's a pay period. And so we will be doing some grocery shopping tomorrow. Wanted to make sure everything was all tidy and tossed away. And I went into the freezer because I've noticed something weird about my freezer, by the way, that all the odors from the fridge seem to move upward and then just linger like forever in the freezer. So it's like...
Is your freezer above your... Yes. It's not a side-by-side. It's
no,
a top-bottom.
Yeah, it's above. All right. All right. So long after the chicken that kind of got a little gamey has been gone, there's this icky like kind of chicken smell still in the freezer. Like the smell itself was frozen in place.
Honey, did you get chicken Frogurt again? It's...
but I'm digging through the freezer. And I'm throwing a couple of things away and doing something. And I found something that I can't say I actually had forgotten that I had this in the freezer, but I hadn't really thought about it for a while. And so, whenever it was, 4.5, 5 years ago, it's been a while, when I had my hip replaced. When I was talking to the doctor, he was explaining to me, you know, the process of how your hip is replaced.
Right.
And what they do is they sort of, you know, cut you open and then kind of disconnect you like a chicken. And they cut off the ball off of the top of your femur, which is the ball that goes into the socket in the pelvis.
Right. This is okay. So it's like so there's your pelvis, and then there's the femurs. Is that your thigh?
Yeah, that's your big old thigh bone.
And so there's like a it keeps your pelvis from coming apart. Basically,
right, but
when
it's
you're
also walking
in the street.
It rolls around in the socket in your pelvis.
Okay, yeah.
And so that was, and so they cut that off. And then they basically like jam a titanium spike down in the top of your leg bone that has a titanium ball on the end of it.
Do you have metal in you now?
I do. I have both of my hips have been replaced by titanium.
All right. Now, everybody I know asks this, but do you go off when you go through the airport metal detector thing?
Oh, yes.
Do you have to tell them, like, I got me some metal legs?
I tell them ahead of time, and then they still make me step aside to the area of shame, and they wand me down, and they pat me down, and they make sure that I'm not pretending that I have fake hips just because I'm carrying explosives. Yeah.
Okay.
But, so when I was talking to the doctor during the first procedure, and he said they were going to be doing this, and he showed me the chart and showed me the pictures and showed me the thing that goes in and showed me everything, I said, so can I have it? And he said, have what? I said, well, when you cut the ball off the femur, can I have it? And he said, I guess.
He didn't say, like, what is wrong with you?
I said, well, I just decided to ask you now, because obviously I'll be unconscious and that sort of thing. If I ask you now, maybe you could put it in the chart, and that way you'll remember and put it aside for me for later.
I don't want you throwing it away.
And he kind of looked at me and I said, has no one ever asked you that before? And he looked at me and he said, no one has ever asked me that before.
Now, that does surprise me, actually.
It's, I know. You think someone would have asked.
You think it would have occurred? I mean, but maybe it doesn't occur to them, as you said, until they're recovering or they're all doped up on Vicodin or something. Or they're just sitting there floating on a pink morphine cloud. And they think, man, I should ask for that section of my hippocampus. And then they're just asleep again.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah. So when I woke up after the surgery, it was sitting there on the thing in this little cup right here.
Ah!
And so
I didn't realize, I'm sorry, I'm really not grossed out by it, but I didn't realize that's what that was the whole time. It was like you just sort of whipped it out of nowhere just now.
So it's right here.
This looks like a urine specimen bottle.
Which I think is what it is. It's like a urine specimen cup with a little lid. But they put a little sticker on it with my name on it so that they knew that this belonged to me. And then, of course, I put it in the freezer because it was still covered, you know, with meat from me.
Let me just take a moment. I apologize to everyone. Everywhere who's listening right now, especially if you're attempting to have any sort of lunch while listening to this. I didn't really realize. It's not like Don and I just sitting with sort of, you know, and plan out the show like on a spreadsheet or something beforehand. So I didn't really understand we were going to be talking about Don meat during the
during the program. Well, we're not really talking about the Don meat.
Not as such.
Well,
no.
We are a little bit.
Because that would be weird.
The thing is, I put it in the freezer because, you know.
That's what you do.
Yeah.
Because you don't want it to go bad.
Well, yeah, and I was going to be laid up for a while, and I wasn't going to be able to do anything about it.
What was your plan? When you asked the doctor, look, while you're in there shaving off bits of my hip and my pelvis, can you just stick some of that in a jar for me? Did you have an end game? Was there some sort of, is this going to be made into a belt buckle or something at some point?
You've been to my house. I like, you know, bones and skulls and devices and creepy dolls and things like
that's
that.
True.
And so it's like if somebody's taking, you know, something out of me, I want it.
Okay.
So, I think it'll be cool, you know. So, but then I had to put it in the freezer so that it wouldn't, like, go bad or anything. And so I figured what I would do is that I'd clean it up and I'd have it. But then I never did.
Right.
So like 4 years went by. This thing's still been beating around in my freezer. So last night I decided it was time to, yesterday afternoon, last night I decided to do it. So I boiled a pot of water on the stove and I boiled it up and cleaned it up.
I had no idea this was going to be what we were talking about at the beginning of today's program.
I got a scrub brush out and I cleaned it up.
Did you use, now when you say a scrub brush, was it the plasticky bristly kind or did you have to get like a Brillo pad?
No, it's the plasticky bristly kind.
All right.
And so here you have, right here.
So that's a section of your pelvis. Or of your,
no, that was,
it's of your
you
your
can
femur.
Touch it. It's not going to hurt you.
I'll touch it here. I'm working up to it.
It's half. Basically, they cut it off. They didn't get it all in one piece. But it's the top half of the ball of my femur. But you can also see by looking at it, you get a good idea of what goes wrong when somebody has severe arthritis. Because you can see how gnarled up it is on a couple of sides from calcium deposits. And that's why I had to have it taken off and replaced.
Here's the thing. And this really is saying something.
So there's a piece of my body, a body part from me, like on the table right by your laptop.
If you had asked me this morning to list the 1,000 phrases most likely to be used during today's program, if you had asked me to list the 10,000, if I had had the fabled infinite number of monkeys typing on an infinite number of typewriters, creating a list of things that we would be talking about or conglomerations of words that would come out of your mouth, here's a piece of my body, I'm putting it on the table. Or, would you like to hold a gnarled section of my femur?
I had to boil the Dawn meat off of the bone.
This is one of those moments where, and this really is saying something. No offense. I don't mean this as an indictment of you personally. Not as such. Hmm. This may be the most disturbing and off-putting conversation we have ever had on the show. And we've had a lot of really, really disgusting, repellent, horrifying conversations.
We have.
You were talking about nearly having sex with your uncle not too many weeks ago. And I mean, really, this is one of those times where I'd just like to know what's going on in the mind of the audience. So,
well, someone in the text box did say, you really boiled it? Sweet God, that is fantastic.
What did you, after you boiled it, I feel like I got to know everything. Did you take like a before and after photo of your femur before and after you boiled it?
No, because it looked just like that. Only right. It had like.
Did you just pour it? You poured it down the drain or whatever when you were done?
Yeah, because it was just.
You're going to give that pan a good 5 or 6 washings, I would imagine.
Well,
it's
already been one and gone right. Through the dishwasher okay. And stuff. But,
all right, so just. Here's the thing about this section of your body, this section of your femur bone that's sitting on the table. I almost don't want to pick it up. Not because I'm grossed out by it, but just because I realize that's a thing I can only do once, and then that moment of discovery is going to be over. I feel like I have to give it a second, and I really have to sort of work toward that.
Okay.
All right. I honestly have no, as Meg Ryan says in Joe vs. the Volcano, I have no response to this. This is really, and I'm so glad that I didn't do anything last night, because if I'd try to tell you, and I had the most interesting evening last night, you wouldn't believe the evening I had. It was exceptional in every way. There's really no way that would not have immediately been trumped and superseded by this. I mean, this is sort of like a conversation ender. Okay, now that you've got it,
mm-hmm.
This is maybe a thing we should have the audience weigh in on. So now that you've got this section of your femur that is, as you said, boiled and cleaned and, ready to face the rest of its life, what is it you're going to do with it? You got a cane. Have you thought about putting it on top of the cane?
I did. Originally, when I asked if I could have the whole femur ball, I thought, well, for one thing, I thought it would be bigger than it is. It's really about the size of, it's a little bit larger than a golf ball, I think. Yeah. I thought it would actually have more substance to it. I thought about like having it made into the head
of a cane.
Like
a silver top head of a cane, like Richard Attenborough?
I could have it encased in lucite. And put in the top of the cane.
Make
but the thing is, I'm going to get my knee fixed at some point, and then I won't need the cane anymore, but I'll still have the femur ball. So
no. Here's the thing.
I don't know what to do with it.
No, how about this? You take it, you put it inside, as you said, sort of like a half, what do you call it? Like a half sphere of lucite, but a bit like a paperweight, basically.
Yeah.
Sort of like, make it like a snow globe, almost. But yeah, you just get it, inside a half sphere of lucite, and then you can use it to... Okay, no. I got an even better idea. You're a poker player. It could be your card holder.
You're right. It could. It could be my little, like, everybody.
Everybody's got their little totem,
yeah,
their little good
like
luck charm
Scott
that Dally they put
down. Yeah, has that little smoking bunny thing. And that could be my little totem that I use when I play poker.
No, because if you play cards, you know, there's a thing where they deal you your cards and then you have something to hold them down or you put on top of them. So as they are dealing out additional cards or cards are being sort of thrown around the table, they don't mix with yours. So your cards, are kept separate. And so like a breeze or whatever doesn't blow them over. You totally use that because here's the thing. It'll have another distinct advantage. It will unnerve the opposition. I would imagine that
what
it'll
that,
freak
that?
Out the other
oh,
players
my,
to a demonstrable degree.
That was from my femur.
You should create alternate stories for it, though. Like, you know, there's the actual real story, which is that, you know.
That's
from
a hobo I killed in Bakersfield.
See, if you said that, and then you just give him like a long, steely glare. You know, just make a lot of unbroken eye contact after that point, and then maybe twitch occasionally or just bark now and again.
Maybe when we, if we do a big fundraising event for Emerson News Network, I could raffle it off.
Oh, sir. Okay, I'm going to place a preemptive bid on that. Jesus, God.
Somebody in the text box asks, when I get my knee fixed, will I then have a piece of my knee?
I was going to ask the same thing, if you'll have a kneecap, perhaps.
When I get my knee done, I am having a total knee replacement. So, yes, if I could, if they will put my knee parts aside for me, I will then have my knee parts as well.
I like, you're like the Jason X of the Rick Emerson Show, whatnot. You're eventually just going to get a brand new, like an exoskeleton. And all of you, if they replaced you part by part, piece by piece, eventually you would have a whole duplicate of yourself. We could, you know,
I will be more powerful than you can imagine.
If we got all of your bones replaced one by one, how weird would this be? This is how my mind works. And I am not stoned, by the way. I'm not under the influence of any drug, not any illegal drug. If we got all of your bones replaced one at a time, you could actually still be here doing the show and your complete skeleton could be hanging on the wall of the studio.
Yes.
How weird would that be?
That would be great.
All right. I apologize to everybody everywhere for everything that happens on this program yesterday, today, and tomorrow. All right, so we'll go to the news. Part of me thinks like you should leave this in here, like when the Fun Employment Radio guys come in, when Sarah and Greg come in.
I'm going to leave it on the counter. I will. I'll leave it on the table and move my stuff. And then when Sarah brings her stuff in, then I can come in and go, oh, I'm sorry. I left that here. And she'll say, what is it? And then I'll tell her.
But
and she'll scream.
Leave it sitting over by her seat there because she sits where you sit. So leave it kind of sitting there. And then, leave something behind that you have to come in for other than this. Go, oh, and I left that part of my femur in here. Pardon me. Let me just, I'm glad I boiled it last night. Give me a second here. Just so I can be here. I might see if I can actually just have like a camera rolling or something. Awesome. All right, it's 503-505-6964. Coming up later on the day, Snuff Watch, Penis Watch, Monkey Watch, Anna Griffin from The Oregonian will be here. We will have today's top five as well. Top five first songs from the first side of a first album. Don't forget joining, if you join us tomorrow afternoon, we'll be talking to Mr. Dave Mustaine from Megadeth, and coming up next week, sci-fi fantasy author Terry Brooks. That is all on the way. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program at the News Desk. This is Don Taylor.
And now, from the News Desk, this is Don Taylor.
A Vancouver woman was upgraded to fair condition Wednesday and faces surgery for injuries from an attack Monday evening in which an assailant threw an acidic liquid in her face. Bethany Starrow, 28, was taken to the burn center of Legacy Emanuel after the attack. Her mother, Nancy Newelt, said her daughter was near Esther Short Park, about 8th and Columbia, around 7:30 p.m. She was getting something out of the passenger side of her car before heading into a Starbucks. A woman walked up to her and said, "Hey, pretty girl, do you want to drink this?" The woman then threw the liquid into her face and ran off.
Oh, that's creepy. See, it was weird enough yesterday when it was just the... I have a question for you. I'm interrupting myself here, but I have to ask this because there seemed to be an astonishing... I mean, relatively speaking, there seems to be an astonishing number of stories in the news where somebody gets acid thrown on them. Where are people getting all this acid? Is it like an acid emporium somewhere that I, you know, Bob's Acid-O-Rama that I'm not aware of? I wouldn't know... This is like on Breaking Bad, the whole thing where you used to figure out how to become a meth dealer. I wouldn't know where to buy acid if you put a gun to my head. I mean, if I had to do it.
Do you still have that battery in the trunk of your car?
Yes, I do.
Well,
I know that I'm supposed to have taken that out by now, but we're all going to have to be okay with
that. There's acid in that.
Yeah, but you can't. But I wouldn't know how to get it out. Mm. It's sort of you can't just be sawing open a battery. It seems like that's going to work out badly for you.
That's what we have the internet for, Rick Emerson.
I guess.
To learn how to get acid out of batteries.
All right. Well, it does seem to be one of those things that people have sort of ready access to, which I find not unnerving, just interesting.
Well, there are cleaning products that are highly corrosive and acidic. There are things you can get at the hardware store, as somebody says in the text box, the gardening store, you can get hydrochloric acid.
Really?
Yeah.
What would you need hydrochloric acid for if you're a gardener? I mean, how tough can a snail possibly be? I was going to say that's what it really is. It's, you know, it's just, you've got that whole cheerleading troop in her attic or something, and it's just taking up space.
Well, anyway, after being splashed with the acid, Starro stumbled about in plane, fell to the ground screaming. A passerby called police using Starro's cell phone. Her brother, Abraham Newelt, posted on his Facebook page, "I am so disgusted with society right now. Yesterday, my little sister got some form of acid thrown into her face while walking through downtown Vancouver. She's currently in the hospital with severe burns and could face permanent damage. This incident was totally unprovoked and malicious in nature. If you believe in prayer, now is the time to ask for a full recovery and that the assailant be brought to justice. I love you, beasts."
All right. Well, you don't normally associate this sort of thing with downtown Vancouver either. It doesn't seem like it's not a real bustling hotbed of humanity in any way, much less the acid-throwing kind. Jesus, God almighty. All right. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program here at rickemerson.com. Don't forget today's show is brought to you by, among other folks, The Cleaning Solution and the person of Mr. Michael Beatty. His number is 971-533-3211, 971-533-3211. We'll talk more about him later on in the program. This is Don Taylor.
Right in the middle of Southeast Portland, endangered salmon are making a remarkable comeback, and they'll soon be swimming under the roadways. For drivers met with road closure signs along Southeast 28th Avenue, it may seem more like an inconvenience, but for Reed College and the city of Portland, it marks the final phase of a major project to bring salmon back to the city. A lot of people don't realize it, but we had thousands and thousands of fish in Johnson Creek in the 50s and 60s, and they've all but disappeared, said Caitlin Lovell of the City of Portland. The work is part of the Reed Canyon Restoration Project that began 10 years ago. The goal of the project is to restore Crystal Springs, a major tributary to Johnson Creek, to the way it was before human development all but blocked it. A fish ladder is the first phase of the restoration project. It was built back in 2000. Before that, the area was a huge slab of concrete. This month, work will wrap up on the final phase to construct a culvert that will allow salmon to pass underneath 28th Avenue.
By the way, somebody says here in the text box, this is what I'm paying my 32 cents a day for. When is the last time Lars Larson had human bones on his countertop? Never. You are correct, sir.
That is a point.
That's what marketers call a point of differentiation between two products. And there you go. All right. That's it. Really, I mean, that... all things being equal, that's worth 45 cents a day,
at least.
So, we don't ask that because we're a Christian people here. Here's Don Taylor.
Indiana State Police say an extra at the Transformers 3 production site was seriously injured during the filming of a stunt. Authorities say the Transformers 3 crew was filming late Wednesday in the Chicago suburb of Hammond, Indiana, using several vehicles and drivers. Police say something went wrong and an object went through the windshield of a car, hitting the driver. In a statement, police said the vehicle kept going for a mile before stopping. Police did not release the driver's name. The person was airlifted to a hospital. Transformers 3 crews have been filming in Chicago all summer.
I saw some footage of Transformers 3 that a guy had posted online. It was really weird, actually. It almost seems like one of those things that had to have been fake, because you can't imagine how the guy would have gotten close enough, but it turned out it was real. They were filming it, and some guy just sort of wandered onto the set where they were filming, and he was just sort of there with his iPhone or whatever, just snapping a bunch of pictures and uploading them. And who is starring in Transformers 3? His name escapes me. It's Shia LaBeouf, but it's the other guy. I want to say Patrick Dempsey, but that's wrong. There is some additional.
Patrick Dempsey.
Is it Patrick Dempsey?
Yeah.
So, which is weird, because I was looking at him and just trying to square the fact that he was the Can't Buy Me Love guy. And, you know, it sort of makes you, he's like Jason Bateman, where it kind of makes you glad when you, even if he's in Transformers 3, it doesn't really matter. You know, you sort of, you feel happy that things worked out for him. Because, I mean, it was sort of a time when I think, you know, that guy was kind of written off as just being.
Yeah, but Frances McDormand is in Transformers 3, too, and what the hell?
That's just one of those things that you take because it allows you to make Coen Brothers films that don't make any money.
I can't believe, though, that she's actually hurting for cash.
I don't know.
One thing, she's married to one of them.
Well, that's true. I suppose that helps. Isn't she on Weeds, too? I'm almost positive she's on Weeds. Weeds is the weirdest show because I've heard a lot of episodes of Weeds because our living room of the television is adjacent to the office I have at home. So if the sort of home office door is closed, I don't hear. But if it's open at all, you know, Lara's on this whole power loading thing where she's going through, you know, like a season every two or three days. And so I hear a lot of those episodes in rapid succession. For example, for the longest time, I was convinced that What's-Her-Guts, who plays Tara on True Blood, was on Weeds, because there's an actress who has a voice that is identical to hers. I mean, it's like, it is like the Pepsi Challenge thing. Where it's like, it's, I would swear to God that it's her, but apparently it's not. So either Frances McDormand is on Weeds, or there's somebody who sounds a lot like her. Speaking of Weeds and Showtime, we got to remember that this coming Sunday, Dexter returns.
Yes.
So Dexter returns to the air this coming Sunday.
So does that mean now on Monday mornings when I get up, I have to watch both Mad Men and Dexter before
yes.
I come into work?
Yes, it does. But it's but see, but you're no worse off. Don't have me, because you're no worse off than you were a couple weeks ago when you were watching True Blood
I know,
and
but
Mad Men.
But like with you, though, it's kind of like, whew, there's 45 more minutes I've got to do stuff.
Well, that's, see, I'm glad I made that decision, because it's like the good Lord has blessed me with a 25th hour in my day that I no longer have to sit there and watch Anna Paquin, you know, hacking her way through a bunch of stilted, poorly written dialogue. God damn, have you seen the cover of, you said Entertainment Weekly, that's got the cover of, you know, it's Bill and Sookie on the, you know, with, because they just got married and whatever.
Yeah.
He's got a weird-looking face. I thought he was sort of an attractive guy, but you take a good long look at him in a good light. His face...
They're both odd-looking people.
Well, and see, to her, I with Anna Paquin, I thought it was just like the gap in the teeth. That certainly doesn't help matters, and it's especially not going to help things when she gets to be like 50, because Madonna's sort of a roadmap there, where you see that starts to look bad. It starts to work out poorly. She has just got sort of a... She has to work really, really hard, or she's going to slip into looking like poor white trash kind of thing going on. Where, you know, if she just kind of consistently keeps the polish on, and if she really just gives it the old collar, she swings for the fences every morning in front of the mirror, she can probably avoid looking like a rube from Kentucky. But if she were to slip up for even a day, I think you'd be able to, you know, you can just see her like working at a pie house somewhere. The thing about Stephen Moyer, is that his name,
yeah.
The guy that plays Bill? His face has got this strange, it's like someone hit him really hard in the face with something that was perfectly flat. Or maybe that his face was just softened up a bit long enough that they could rolling pin it. Because it just seems, it's like he's got almost a perfect cube of a face sitting on top of his shoulders.
And
he's a very off-putting
tiny,
looking
and
man.
And tiny little soulless eyes.
Rodent-like eyes, I would say,
yeah.
Don. Yes. All right, here's Don Taylor at the news desk.
Machete, which opens Friday, is a film Robert Rodriguez has wanted to make since the mid-1990s, and even before the movie's official debut, questions about possible sequels are already popping up. Rodriguez weighs in.
I mean, I think these are the actors, I think that's what people like about them, is that they're real, real men. I mean, back in the day, you'd shake a tree and out would fall, you know, Lee Marvins and Charles Bronsons and things, and now, you know, it's so hard to find guys that have actually lived a life. And I think that's why movies like Expendables did well. And, you know, because kids play these video games that are all based on those types of characters. They're playing these larger-than-life characters. And they're not really seeing that in a real daily life, except in movies like this. So I think that's what's the draw. And yeah, once I put it out there, that original trailer, people just wanted the movie so badly, they chased me around till it was made. So now that I've put at the end titles that Machete Kills and Machete Kills Again is coming, well, I'm going to hear that until I make it. So, and from him, too. So, yeah, it'll probably be sequels.
So is that okay? I was going to ask you, you know, in a non-spoiler way to tell us if there's sequels, but it sounds like...
Yeah, at the very end of the movie, it says, Machete, in the classic kind of early 80s, late 70s kind of movie, Machete will return in Machete Kills.
That's
fantastic. And then it says, and... Machete Kills Again.
See, that's... So. I really have to say that whether or not this movie is successful at the box office, and I have a sense it will be, I have a sneaking suspicion that Machete's going to do real big business. It's so great to see a guy, and Tarantino does this too with varying degrees of effectiveness, and they're not the only ones. But it's great to see Rodriguez do this, because the thing about Robert Rodriguez films is they... Even the ones that are sort of serious, even if you watch like Desperado or something, you can just tell that the guy has like a real film-loving zeal to him. I mean, you can tell that is a guy who loves movies and he loves having a good time. And I always say this about Stephen King novels. If you read some of the best work by Stephen King, even as Stephen King is describing something that is horrifying or terrible or particularly violent or morbid, there is always, you can always sort of sense the presence of Stephen King, the author, lurking just behind the actual text of the book. And I can visualize Stephen King sort of rubbing his hands together and cackling with evil glee over a typewriter as I'm reading something particularly like revolting that he's written. And I get that with Rodriguez, too, where he just seems to be having a great time. And people can tell if a filmmaker, I think, is having a good time behind the camera because it turns, you know, it turns up and stuff like that.
And the thing is with Machete, because, you know, I saw Machete the other night, and I loved the hell out of it. I really did.
Would you see it again?
Oh, yeah. I'd see it again. And with the Planet Terror, you can tell he's having a really good time, and the movies end up being really good. Then there's his Spy Kids franchise, in
right.
which he seems to be having a really good time. And once you get past the first one, they're crap. They're just crap.
Right.
So it's kind of, there's having a good time, and then there's having a good time. What I'm looking forward to next is... when Grindhouse came out, Rodriguez had a contest through South by Southwest Film Festival for people to make their own Grindhouse trailers. And one of those trailers was one that someone made called Hobo with a Shotgun. And it got picked up, and it is being made into a film.
What's it about?
It's about a hobo with a shotgun. In the trailer, it's described, as they describe it on Wikipedia, in the trailer, a vagabond with a 20-gauge shotgun becomes a vigilante. In the trailer, he's shown killing numerous persons ranging from armed robbers to corrupt cops to a pedophilic Santa Claus. They're making a movie, Hobo with a Shotgun, and the hobo with a shotgun will be played by Rutger Hauer.
I'm sold. I'm in.
Yes.
Sell me a ticket now. It's a good time to be alive. It really is. I know that people often have this sort of lament that the golden age of whatever has passed, but the golden age of nothing has passed us by. The golden age of everything is right goddamn now. I'm telling you, as sure as I know my own name, I know that that's true. I want to read one of these messages here that I got. This is from listener Eloise. Listener Eloise said... I just finished watching The Wire tonight. By the way, let me just... I was having dinner with some friends last night, and it was sort of two... We've been having this whole discussion on this show lately about my whole cell phone thing and whether I got an iPhone or a Droid or whatever. And so we were having dinner last night, and Cheryl was actually there. And, of course, Cheryl would rather have her feet set on fire than hear any more discussion of what phone I'm going to buy. But half the table last night was, like, iPhone users, and half the table was Droid users. And I didn't really think about it. It was not I sort of inadvertently stumbled into the whole somebody had their iPhone out and they were making a connection. And I said, "Hey, how do you like that iPhone? Is that working out for you?" And it's like Cheryl, I could hear her teeth grinding together. And I'm pretty sure that underneath her breath she went, "Jesus God almighty." And because immediately the table devolved into just, and I mean, it was astounding. And let me just say this. If/when, I mean, whatever I get, whether it's a BlackBerry or whether it's an iPhone. And by the way, every iPhone user at the table used to have a BlackBerry. So things are trending that way. Spare me the additional emails. I'm just saying that's the way it looks. Sources are sort of pointing to iPhone. But anyway, but if I ever get an iPhone or a Droid or whatever, I'm going to make a vow right now that what I'm not going to be, I just can't be that guy that sits there and goes, "Hey, have you seen the app that?" No one needs to be that guy ever again, because everybody is familiar with the app that. Everybody has seen the app. And the thing is, if you start that, there's no stopping it, because there's like 50,000. There's no way to tell, and I told this story last night, there's no way to sort of tell it here without name dropping, so I apologize. But I was fortunate enough last year to interview Harry Shearer, and he actually came to the studio. It was really cool. He just sat across the table from me, and we talked for like 45 minutes. And he's the coolest guy, and he's smart, and he's funny, and he makes $400,000 an episode on The Simpsons. So that was like going through my head the entire time. He was talking, and actually, as we were doing the interview, in the back of my head, I was calculating exactly how much money he would be making if it were a Simpsons episode, like right now. So by the end of the interview with him, if that had been a Simpsons episode, he would have made $800,000. You try to interview somebody who makes $400,000 for 22 minutes of dialogue and see if that Fs with your head a little bit. So we had this whole great, fantastic interview, and then we were done. We turned off the mics. The microphone wasn't off like 10 seconds. When Harry Shearer just pulls out his iPhone and goes, "Have you seen this app?" And it was like, you know, it was like some app where you can take somebody's picture And then you can put your picture, you can put your finger on the screen and move it around and like kind of warp and mutate their face. And this was the thing that Harry Shearer couldn't wait to talk to me about. This was the issue of great social and political import that he had to share with me. Anyway, so there's the whole iPhone droid conversation happening at the table last night. And the only conversation which is more passionate and more exclusionary than that is a conversation between Wire fans in the vicinity of people who have never seen The Wire. So last night, half the table, big hardcore Wire fans, including Cheryl, I might add. The other half of the table, never seen it. And they all politely suppressed, like, an irritated groan as we started talking about it. That is all in aid of this. This is from listener Eloise. And listener Eloise says, hey, Rick Nam, best show ever. I just finished watching The Wire tonight, hugely based on the recommendation of yourself and my parents. And now I'm going to sink into the deepest depths of depression for many reasons. The loss of the show, loss of certain characters, loss of the meaning of my life, etc. Also, Rick Emerson, I live in the heart of Southeast Portland and I cannot effing find those peanut butter stuffed chocolate bugles anywhere. Please to be telling me the location. Also, the pesto mozzarella chips. It haunts me and every poor day I interrogate the store owners about them and no one ever finds them. And it just ends, I'm going to eat a taco now. So there you go. So that's listener Eloise. Thank you so much. All right.
I love Eloise.
She's my new favorite person.
I guess I should remove my femur ball from the table before Anna Griffin comes in.
I was about to ask you if you wanted to leave it there or if you wanted to have, if you wanted to see if she would ask what it was.
Maybe I should put it, this is only her second time here. I should probably put that aside for now.
All right.
You still haven't touched it.
Here's the thing is, I find it kind of oogie.
Well, of course you do.
I feel like I shouldn't. I feel like I'm less than a man. Like I, this is.
There's nothing oogie left on it. It's been. Cleaned up and polished to a fine.
I mean, sheen. I will. I'm just saying. I have to say, it kind of creeps me out a little bit, and that's embarrassing to admit. And I don't know why, because I think probably that's the normal reaction. It's taken me about 20 minutes to work up to admitting this. I was trying to be all manly and like hard about it, but I get, you know, probably most people would be weirded out by it. Sarah certainly will be when we surprise her with it later this afternoon. Maybe we could leave the mics on for that.
I was going to suggest that.
You know, the thing is, they're on. They get here. The Fun Employment guys get here at like 3. So it's not like it's out of the realm of possibility that we could just invite them into the studio to ask them to have like a little crossover, maybe promotional segment at the end of our show.
Just have it sitting there.
And then wait to see if she says, like, what is that? And I go, oh, it's part of Don's femur bone. She had to boil it clean of bits of herself last night. in any event. But I feel like it shouldn't bother me, even though it would bother most people, because, you know, because I'm Rick Emerson. I traffic in the weird and the vile and the absurd. It is the coin of the realm here on the program. And yet I got to say, you know what weirds me out about it?
It is weird to look at something. I mean, it's weird for me to look at it. It was in me. But to realize that that's something that was inside a person, not just inside a person who's sitting across the table from you.
Yeah, see, but that doesn't bother me, because by that rationale, you couldn't ever look at like a baby, because you'd realize it like it used to be in somebody. And that doesn't weird me out all that much. Here's what weirds me out about it. And I'm not trying to be revolting, but there's just no way to not talk about this whole thing. So if you joined us late for some reason, sitting on the table here at the Emerson News Network is, I swear to Christ, a piece of Dawn's femur bone from when she had surgery on her hips. And it is half of the sort of ball socket combination. It's the ball part of the ball socket combination. And so it's just half of it. Here's what weirds me out about this. It's not that it was in you. It's not that they had to cut it out of you during surgery. It's not that it's a thing that normally you would never, because this is, to be honest, unless I was in a museum or something, this is probably the first time I've ever seen one of these ever. Because, like, how often do you get to inspect somebody's bones? Like, very rarely, once or twice a year, like, tops.
And you don't often see human bones. Well, you see, animal bones when you're making food and stuff, but you don't see actual human bones.
And by the way, here's the other thing, and I should mention this, I suspect, because I saw her subscription information go by in my email a few minutes ago, I suspect that my house guest is listening right now to this program, because I saw her name go by in the hallway. You have a new subscriber. I get a little alert whenever there's a new subscriber. So I suspect she's listening. If you just discovered that human skull in my office by mistake, I'm sorry, I should have warned you about that. It's like I'm looking at this little section of your femur bone on the counter. I have like a full-on, like a real actual human skull from like, I believe like a 13-year-old, you know, no less, sitting in my office at home. So it's not like it's the idea that it's a human bone that I find unnerving. It is the fact that, and you should take a picture of this maybe and put it up online later. It is the fact that it looks like a miniature, part of a miniature skull. You know, there's like the little cap part, the little hat part on the top of your head. It looks like the top of a miniature human skull, like if you had sort of a Lilliputian skull. Like if a shrunken head had a shrunken skull inside, this would be the top of it. That's what weirds me out.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to pick it up right now. Then we'll do, I never thought I'd say this. I'll be picking up Dawn's femur here in just a second. Then we'll take a brief break. We'll come back with Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. Later on, we have a snuff watch, penis watch, monkey watch, and the top five first songs from a debut album today. That is a song one, side one. I am elongating this whole conversation here just so I can avoid picking it up. All right, here we go. All right. And, that's just weird. Oh, that's bizarre, and it's sort of like it's almost like hollow.
Well,
sort of.
Yeah, that's because I think that's because if you see there's the little serrated lines on the inside. I think that's from where the kind of saw they use.
Now it sort of looks like it looks like
some of the text box says, "I dare you to touch it to your tongue."
I wonder what I might be offered to do that. I can be bought. Well, look, I paid Aaron Duran $20 to lick a handrail in Las Vegas. And he did it, by the way. Aaron Duran licked a metal hand railing outside the Venetian in Las Vegas on the Strip.
Oh, wow.
$20 I gave him. And it wasn't like he—and here's the thing.
This guy was freaked out by hair, but he'll do that.
No, and it wasn't just like he touched his tongue to it. I made him—like, he had to move—he had to put the flat of his tongue, not the tip— He had to put the flat of his tongue on a metal, it was a brass handrail outside the Venetian in Vegas, and then he had to actually, the tongue had to traverse a 6-inch, it had to move 6 inches. He had to actually lick 6 inches along the metal handrail, and he did it for $20. So, kids, if you're going to Vegas, the key is wait until your friends are really, really drunk, and you can get them to do almost anything if they think it's enough money to, like, get them another round at the blackjack table. This is weird. It almost looks like the surface of the moon because it's got like it's been struck by meteorites, and that's the arthritis thing.
Yeah, that's.
I didn't know that's what arthritis was.
Yeah, it's
where it's like the bone decays or wears away or something.
Well, actually, it's a buildup of additional
like a calcium deposit. Or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, and stuff does kind of it wears down in some places and then builds up in other places and. Gets weirdly crunchy.
You know what it's shaped like? Don't say that.
Well, that's what it felt like when it was inside me. I would actually make these weird crunch. I could feel this crunching sensation when I was walking.
Are you like one of those people that has the weird mandibular thing where your mouth is going every time you try to eat lunch?
A little bit, yeah.
All right. Can I say, years ago, as I dated is too strong a word for this. I made time. As they used to say, with a young lady who had that TMJ, the mandibular thing.
Is this going where I think it's going?
Probably not, because it never got that far. Because I was weirded out by the fact that we would. We didn't even have the sex. It was just because it was.
Weirded out during kissing.
That's the thing. It's like we would just be making out, and like about every 30 seconds, her jaw would go. And it was like, and the thing is like, if you are kissing. If you're kissing somebody and it's, you know, it's the full-on sex kissing, then, then the weird thing is it's like your mouth hooked to her mouth and it becomes like an echo chamber and everything becomes a lot louder, sort of like how noises inside your own head, nobody else can hear them. But it's like, so we would be, you know, macking, as the young people say, and her mouth would go like, and it would echo inside my brain, and it would just. And then after like the 17th time, I was like, "Oh, look at the time! I have that early morning meeting. I've got to go."
My jaw only does that if I opened my mouth really, really wide. But then once I noticed it did that, I sat there one night. I was like watching TV, and I just kept going. "That's not right."
Okay, wow! I just heard that. We're taking a break now. Your body is not allowed to do anything strange, and you're not allowed to remove anything from it for the duration of the program.
I didn't realize you'd be able to hear that in the mic.
Your bones are off limit. That's a $700 microphone you're sitting behind. That's going to pick up every little sound your body makes. I am so weirded out right now. I am so deeply unnerved. Jesus Christ. All right, coming up next hour, which is actually this hour, Anna Griffin from The Oregonian, Snuff Watch, Penis Watch, Monkey Watch, Top 5, and so forth. You stay there. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program right here on the Emerson News Network.
When you walk through the garden, He's got the fire and the fury at his command. Well, you don't have to worry if you hold on to Jesus' hand, and we'll all be safe from Satan.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Greetings and salutations to you. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. So there was just the most glorious and awkward moment. Actually, there's a whole series of awkward moments linked together into one sort of repellent audio chain that's been happening. So just now we went into the break, and I didn't even know in what order to... I didn't even know in what order to tell all of these things. So we went into the kitchen slash green room just now, and I was bringing Anna Griffin into the studio. Anna Griffin from the Oregonian. Hello, how are you?
Hello, Rick.
See, now you are. You're doing the NPR delivery. The last time you were here, I will just dovetail these two things together. The last time you were here, you were on... It's not a bad microphone. It's the microphone that we kind of stash over in the corner, and it is like a microphone of last resort.
It had a Fisher-Price feel to it.
It's not like a high-quality piece of electronic equipment. It has a little bit of a hollow sound to it. So you are now on the actual guest microphone, which is really fantastic, and you noted that it gives you the NPR sound.
This is Love Lines with Dr. Anna.
That's the thing, and they all do that where it's they turn the microphone up. It's the opposite of what they did, what they taught me to do when I was a young DJ. Because when I was coming up in the game, as they say, what they would tell you to do is they would have you turn down, they would have you pot down the microphone to as low as you possibly, and then just scream into it. And so, if you had seen, or heard, a DJ like myself in that era. Talking, that's why we all did the hue, coming up next hour, we got a big one from Mariah Carey and another nonstop music jam. You're listening to blah, 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 and it just sounds like the guy is, he's just exhorting you, like, with this sort of fire and brimstone sort of thing. And that's because the deal was to turn the mic down and then just yell at the top of your lungs, which is an outgrowth of, like, all that kind of boss jock, Wolfman Jack stuff of the 60s. And then at some point in, like, the 80s or the early 90s, especially with talk radio and NPR specifically, they started doing the opposite, where you turn the microphone up as loud as you can, and then you say, that was Igor Stravinsky. Second movement. Recorded from a live audience last year in Manhattan. You're listening to, and then they just have these long sort of pauses that happen everywhere, and they have the patented, it's what I call, it's sort of like a voice like talcum powder that you get if you are just sort of able to breathe your words into the microphone. And that microphone, Anna Griffin, will let you do that. So
I feel like we're sharing secrets here. It's very intimate.
That's the other thing. And this is a thing that Howard Stern does, actually. Stern turns his mic up really hot, and then he leans in, and he can kind of do this thing. So when you're at home and you're in bed, like how is that, Don? And then he just, you know, and it has that weird sort of just between you and me, like nobody else. That, and he keeps them in a dark room for like 7 hours. Until
what are you doing, pulled over in your automobile by the side of the New Jersey Turnpike?
Exactly. So just now I go into the kitchen and I bring Anna in and you asked me how I was, and I said, well, I'm feeling very disturbed, and I said, do you? And I think I gave you the option of do you want to know why? And, of course, the answer is always yes, because if you say somebody, I feel deserved, do you want to know why, they'll say yes. And then I realized that I don't really have any way to explain this without just without just sounding bizarre. I think what I said when we came into the studio, I think Dawn said, you know, it's only Anna's second time on the show. Don't subject her to that. And realize that Anna still has no idea what we're talking about. Dawn just says, it's only her second time on the show. Don't subject her to that. And I said, well, I'm not going to make her touch it or look at it. I'm just going to tell her about it. So Dawn had surgery on one of her, both of your hips.
Because
she has arthritis or whatever. But right before they gave her the drugs, before they put her under, Dawn had to make a little note on her chart that she wanted to keep part of her femur. That's what I'm saying right there. That's the expression. So we won't make you handle it or nothing. But if you'd been in here a few minutes earlier,
I was showing off your femur.
I wasn't even going to make her look at it. Now you're waving it around.
I wasn't even going to tell her about it. I figured she could come in. We could move on with the show in a nice smooth direction without any discussion of body parts.
No, this is, look, she deserves the full truth. We can't be emotionally dishonest about what kind of program she's on.
Yes, we can.
I made the mistake of looking in your fridge again.
No, so. You don't want to do that. No.
Not good.
That really, really old lasagna is not ours.
The uncovered lasagna that's been left on the top shelf.
It's kind of now it's just sort of there as a sort of half-lifing experiment to see exactly how long it will take for it to degrade.
I don't want to say who that belongs to, Ben, from downstairs, but
it belongs to this strapping young lad in the warehouse downstairs on whom Dawn has an ill-concealed crush. So
I do not actually have a crush on him. I just admire him as a fine specimen of manhood.
Is that
not the same thing as a crush.
A sort of an aesthetic appreciation.
Exactly. It's sort of like, this is the thing I tend to look at it. It's like if you are looking in the showroom window of someplace that has beautiful and very expensive sofas, you may look at them and say, wow, that is a gorgeous sofa. Does not mean you actually want the sofa, that it would go in your home, that it is even your particular taste of sofa. You just go, man, that is a good-looking sofa.
Now, see, and that is the difference between, this is the difference between between men and women, in that men will say that, but it's a lie. That's the thing. Like men, and it's always when they get caught looking at somebody else. And you know, and they say, I saw you looking at that waitress. You go, no, baby, I just, I just appreciate beauty. I mean, not like your beauty, which is singular in nature. But men will try to, you know, it's the thing of like, it's just appreciating a fine painting or a vase. Which is just a load. I mean, that's a tissue of lies.
You would take
the
vase home and do some things to the vase.
Exactly. I would defile the vase in a most horrific fashion. Look, it's not me. It's just it's a chromosomal thing. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm saying, I believe you when you say that.
And because I have no problem admitting when I do have unseemly crushes on people. But but in this case,
Peter Carlin, for example.
Peter Carlin.
Whatever you do, don't tell Peter Carlin that Dawn has an ill-concealed crush on him as
he's
well.
He's a good-looking guy, Peter Carlin.
Here's the thing about Peter Carlin that appeals to Dawn is that the thing about Peter is, you know, he's an attractive man. He's got the youthful thing but the mature thing going on at the same time. And, of course, you know, he's smart and he's funny. He's successful. But it's also that he's not so secretly perverse. And that about every fifth statement that comes out of his mouth is vile in some way that you don't really anticipate. And I think it's the sort of, like, I think that's what it is. It's like the sneak attack horrific nature of some of his statements that holds an appeal for Dawn because it kind of keeps you off balance. He's a little unpredictable.
Yeah, I find that is what appeals to me in people in general. if they can say things that surprise me and make me go, what? Then it's like, oh, I like you. So.
On the way, we have Snuff Watch coming up, Monkey Watch on the way, Penis Watch as well. Top five today. We'll do the top five first songs, first side from a first album. So the top five first songs from the first album of a band or artist and so forth. Plus, we'll talk about what's coming up in the Oregonian. At the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Well, let's do that Snuff Watch,
all
shall
right,
we?
Hold on a second here. This is your Snuff Watch for, what is today, Thursday?
Yes.
For Thursday, right here on the Rick Emerson radio program. Here is Don Taylor with your Snuff Watch for Thursday.
Northwest wrestling legend Anthony Wayne Tough Tony Bourne Osborne passed away following complications from having a pacemaker placed in his heart. He was 84. Born in Columbus, Ohio, Anthony Osborne began wrestling in high school and then in the U.S. Navy. Columbus promoter Al Hart convinced him to give professional wrestling a shot. Osborne recalled, "When I got into the business, I slept in the gym, and the only heat in the wintertime was from the hot water tank. Back then, $25 to $35 was a good payoff. I was born 30 years too soon."
So what league did he wrestle in? Was it the Northwest Wrestling Association or the... It was called the NWA, and I forget what it stands for, but I think it was the Northwest Wrestling Association, and it was a regional league that, well, you're not from around these parts.
No, I don't
you
know.
You wouldn't know.
I don't know these things.
No, there's a wrestling, I mean, it's not, you know, wrestling's also big, you know, it's in a lot of places, but every decade or so, for most of the 20th century, there would be a regional league that would spring up, sort of before the WWE kind of just consumed everything. So there was on the East Coast, there was the ECW, and there was some equivalent to that in the South. But here in the Northwest, there was a thing called the NWA, and there was, I think, maybe the AWA as well, but it was especially big in Oregon. And my grandma, and they used to wrestle in, like Malala or someplace. It couldn't have been Malala. It might have been in Oregon City. But my grandmother would go, and she was just, you know, my grandmother was sort of awesome for all the same reasons that she was horrible. Because she was, you know, kind of in the bag, you know, not half in the bag. I mean, like in the bag half of the time. And so she would go and she would watch these guys at, I believe, the league where he wrestled. And she would watch them go and throw down on a Friday night or whatever. And it was awesome to go and watch the thing in person, because if you had a sufficient amount of money, you could actually bring a foreign object that they would then use on their opponent. But they wouldn't do it for free. And so during that, they would occasionally, and they were, it was sort of great in a way, because it wasn't like it wasn't the moneyed sort of event or sport or whatever that it's become now. I mean, they were pretty upfront about the fact that, you know, they had to get paid, and so guys would stop. They were kind of like strippers, and that every now and again they would kind of stop, or they would slow down the action, you know, and kind of indicate to folks that it was time to cough up a little money. And you would go down, and you would put $5 or whatever on the ring. And if you put down, I think, at least five or maybe it was 10, you could then hand them something. And my grandmother brought in like a frying pan or something at one point, and she put down like a $10 bill and a frying pan. And the guy was like, "All right, no problem." And he tucked like the $10 into his pants or whatever, and he grabbed the frying pan, and he just worked the other guy. Like, he just beat the other guy like he was the family mule. It was awesome. So those were, it was a simpler time.
Were you allowed to put the bills in their little wrestling pants, or?
I don't know, actually. Not that my grandmother would have been opposed to that sort of thing, so. She was a barmaid, and she kind of lived life. She lived a little fast and loose while she was here. She enjoyed her life.
Well, Tough Tony Bourne wrestled on cards from Texas to Utah to Idaho throughout the 50s. He came to the Pacific Northwest and settled in Oak Grove in 1962. When inducting him to the Ring Around the Northwest Newsletter Hall of Fame, Mike Rogers wrote, "Tony Bourne was Portland wrestling throughout the 60s and early 70s. He held the Northwest title 9 times and tag titles 19 different times. His team with Lonnie Main is still remembered as the most successful in Northwest history, as they held the tag titles 10 times. Tough Tony's last match was in October 8, 1981. He hadn't planned on quitting, but, quote, 'Your body tells you,' he said. Tony got into the real estate business in the 70s, was also a licensed superintendent for the American Kennel Club, and also enjoyed tending to his family's gardens. He was described by his family as a very involved, passionate, and loving man.
Fantastic.
The family is planning a memorial at the Milwaukee Elks Lodge that will be announced at a later date.
That's how I want to go out. I want to go out and have my I want to have my memory toasted at an Elks Lodge somewhere. That's fantastic. All right, there you go. There's your snuff watch for Thursday in the Rick Emerson radio program. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Before we plunge on ahead with this, we still got the top five to get to and all that. Anna Griffin from the Oregonian. How are you? How's life? You were on vacation, right? You were out of town for a while?
I was in the Adirondacks sitting by a lake.
I don't know what that is or where that is.
Mountains in upstate New York.
What?
She's laughing at your ignorance.
I don't know what that is.
What am I sitting here and lie and nod my head sagely? No. The Adirondacks. I've spent many holidays
Lake
with
Placid.
Them and
Lake
their
Placid.
Children.
Have you heard of Lake Placid, New York? Miracle on Ice? Hockey?
Don, would you like to answer her question for her when she says, Rick, you've heard of Lake Placid?
He doesn't know what you're talking about.
The only Lake Placid.
He might know the horror movie.
That's
but
it. I was going to say, if you're talking about the David E. Kelly film featuring a giant alligator in the line, he looked taller. That's the Lake Placid I know. I don't really go places or travel or do things or leave my home except to come here, and then I scurry back home again like a rat. So, anyway. But it's a lake of some kind where you're going to do...
Lovely week. Lovely week. Happy to be back at work.
Excellent. What is going on in the world of Portland and Multnomah County?
Death and destruction and just horrible things.
You said something about... I don't know if I can repeat this on the air, but I suppose by the time I say it, it'll be too late for you to stop me. The one thing you'd mentioned, actually, as we're coming in, is you said that... I mean, I think I actually jotted
quote,
this
yeah,
down.
Yeah, quote it directly.
You said,
I want to quote it right.
TriMet and how they're pissing everyone off.
That's the best writing I'm going to do all week.
I'd be happy to leave it right there, but I suppose we probably should explicate it a bit for the sake of the listeners.
As of this weekend, TriMet is raising rates by a nickel per trip. So I think $2.05 for one or two zones. I don't know.
And I don't remember, when is the last time anybody here actually rode the bus? Don?
I mean,
it's been like 5 years, probably
yeah,
6 years for me. I used to bus it down to the coin center when I went there, but I think I don't remember how much it was then. But it was, I think it had yet to break $2.
Really?
Yeah,
you don't ride the bus?
Maybe. I don't. I'm a terrible person.
I ride the bus. We have a great transit system in Portland.
We do. No, don't. Here's the thing about it. Don't get me wrong, and I don't mean this in an Eddie Haskell kind of way. We really do have a great system of public transportation for people who need it and people who opt to use it for whatever reason, environmental or just for convenience. For a while, I actually did take public transit, not because I care about people or the earth or whatever, but just because I get road rage real easily. And it was just the only way I could avoid being the guy in traffic who's sitting there just, you know, pounding the steering wheel and feeling my blood pressure, you know, waiting for my eyes to blow out of the front of my head. So I did that for a while. And then I think the first time there was a cold snap or something, I just got, you know, the first time I had to stand outside, it was like with bicycling. Bicycling was really easy for me to do until I got a car with heated seats. And it's like once I got the ass warmers or whatever put in the seat, it's like the first time it was so hard to walk by the car to get to the bicycle that I had to stop.
It was calling to you.
Yeah, and it's like some sort of a buttock-oriented siren song.
I just have never lived anywhere that public transportation actually is convenient for me. It's like when I first moved here, I lived in West Lynn. Then I moved to North Portland, like out on the damn peninsula on Lombard. And now I moved from there to Tualatin. So it's like there's just nowhere that I can just hop on the bus and get from bus line to bus line in any kind of a normal, convenient fashion.
Well, that's one of the things that we really do need to expand. There's so many people who live in places where the public transit would... You know what I found out the other day is there's... I think it's actually one of the food banks or the food bank headquarters or whatever, where it's like you go if you're going to get the government cheese or whatnot. There's actually no public transportation near there that you have to like somehow contrive a way to get way out there to it. So we do have great public transportation. I recognize that is the case. That I do not use it, but I do, having lived in a lot of other cities, and Don, you've lived in many places.
I like the end of they're raising it to like $2.05, and the one thing that I think he said it three different times, Christian Fodenvenzel on NPR, saying that people, I can't do his accent, but people are concerned that they're not going to have enough nickels.
Is that
I'm
really?
Like, really? That's what people are, that's what pissing people off.
Does
the fact that
up?
They need nickels.
Well, and so this is being raised because Is it just one of those things where the cost goes up, like, regardless, just because that's what prices do? Or
well, the cost is going up, but they're also cutting service. So they're cutting a couple lines, and they're cutting, you know, they have the frequent service where the bus is supposed to come every 15 minutes, and we've seen dramatic cuts in the number of buses that come often. And so, and we're building light rail to Milwaukee and
so it's one of those
everywhere. And so you question what are the priorities of what's supposed to be a transit agency.
So now is that funded solely by fares and by whatever? Or is that a thing where, like, is it?
Fares are, I think, 20%.
And so is it just like tax dollars?
More than half of it comes from payroll taxes, employment taxes, which means when unemployment goes up, TriMet's in deep trouble.
Right. So they're gonna do that, and then, you know, TriMet's had a bit of a challenging last year anyway. You know, because they've just, I mean, there was that whole thing which I don't think has been resolved yet. Where, I mean, it was maybe 6 months ago where the woman was making a left hand. The TriMet driver, if I remember correctly, she was making a left hand turn or something downtown, and she just drove right through like a gaggle of people that were walking through a crosswalk.
She was just fired last week.
Okay, so, and then today we got the whole ruckus about the guy who claims he saw the TriMet driver texting, which may or may not be the case.
In November, you're going to be asked to approve a bond measure for TriMet.
So what is it? Now, here's the thing. I know almost nothing about the way that things like this operate. So when you say a bond measure, because they talk about bond measures and levies and, you know, whatever, is that all just like code for taxes?
Yes.
I mean, is that all? You know, that's how they sort of mask it sometimes. They say, Well, you're going to have to approve a non-binding bond measure too, but it really is where they're going to hork me for like an additional 1.5% or something.
Exactly. And the difference is a bond measure is they are borrowing money, and so you're going to pay back the debt service on the money they borrowed. A levy is a tax that you pay every year, and that money then goes into operating costs.
All right.
So they use it every year as opposed to building something with it.
See, this is why – here's the thing why you're going to keep coming on the show, because eventually I will become passably intelligent. I mean, it'll be enough to where I'm up to like some sort of median, like a baseline at least.
Can you even repeat back what she just said to you?
No, I cannot. But the thing is, this program is being recorded, so I can listen to it over and over again, you know, like some sort of a book on tape until I've been able to commit it to memory. So
there's a way to do this with the microphone where I could talk very low and sexy and let me explain tax levies to you, Rick.
They should totally have such a service, you know, or you just call it and it's like some...
While you're driving around your car during the day, you should just listen to that.
Yeah. Oregon tax law.
They should actually... There should be some sort of a... because you can get things where you learn like math or you learn language or you learn American history or something, and it's all done, you know, with like audio, you know, with recordings or audio cassettes or whatever they call it now. There should be something where you can get it done with like an alluring voice.
Porn stars, you know, reading the encyclopedia to you.
Totally, yeah. Or you just get like the sort of, you know, you get like the suave sort of, let me now tell you about the nature of covalent bonds and how they are responsible for the underpinnings of life in our cosmos. You know, and it's just, I mean, you know, just a sort of extra bit of elan to your education. I'm a big dork. We're going to talk more with Anna Griffin here in a moment, including the Hung Far Low sign. We were discussing the renovation of that. This is Don Taylor at the news desk.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Portland Mayor Sam Adams has said he will decide the next few weeks whether an officer involved in a deadly shooting will keep his job. Officer Ron Frashour, do you know if I'm pronouncing it, Frashour?
Frazier.
Shot unarmed Aaron Campbell, 25, in the back during a police standoff in January. A review board cleared Officer Frazier of any criminal wrongdoing in the shooting. The shooting and the investigation results led to public outcry and visits to Portland by prominent civil rights leaders, including Reverend Jesse Jackson.
All right, so which, I can't believe I'm saying this, which shooting was this that we're talking about? Because they all sort of just drift together after a while. Was this the thing where he was at his sister's place and he was making a... I'm unclear about whether he had a gun, but it was like he had a gun.
This is the guy who is at his girlfriend's hours after his brother has died.
Right.
He has a gun. He is suicidal. He is saying all sorts of crazy, dangerous things. The cops get called. The cops convince him to come out of the apartment. He doesn't have the gun. He's walking backwards toward them with his hands over his head. Different people are yelling different things at him. One of the officers, who just happens to have removed his communications earpiece, so he doesn't actually know what's going on, thinks he sees him make a move as if he's trying to pull a gun out of the waistband of his pants
right.
and shoots him.
And so do we know, well, I guess we probably don't, but was there any sort of analysis after the fact of what he might have been doing if he wasn't, if he didn't have a gun, have they figured out why he would have been reaching down or?
Different witnesses say different things about what he was actually doing at the time. I mean, a grand jury looked at the case, declined to press charges about anybody, but against anyone, but sent a letter to the DA, which the DA made public, basically saying the entire thing stinks.
Right.
You know, nobody followed procedure. The cops weren't communicating. This guy shouldn't have died.
You know, here's the thing. You got the cops that they have the dashboard camera for traffic stops. When they put, you know, so they're just going to bludgeon somebody by the side of the road. You know, there'll be a record of it at least. Have they thought about doing that whenever there's a police standoff, about mandating some, to whatever extent it's possible, that cops film things like this, especially if it is a standoff where you have, you know, it's not like an ad hoc thing where a guy just suddenly pulls out a gun in a public place. If you're going to a place where a guy has been and he is in some sort of prolonged discussion with the police, do you film? You film the whole thing so there's no questions about it later.
So you're suggesting police videographers?
I'm just saying. Well, here's something. I don't know if I suggested this or if somebody else suggested it. I will take credit for it in lieu of any evidence proving that I did not create this idea myself. But the idea of having a taser that actually has a camera in the end of it. Because if you are required to point a taser, if I'm going to tase Dawn, I am obliged to point the taser directly at her, which means that whatever her movements directly, you know, immediately preceding the tasing would then be captured on film, so there'd be no question about it.
That was a joke item on Boing Boing for April Fool's Day.
Was it really?
It was the taser with the camera.
Okay.
So you could tase people, and then it would automatically upload the video to YouTube for you.
From the mouths of satirists, Dawn, come the greatest of ideas. The thing is, that's fantastic. I mean, if I were running a city, I would buy that in a heartbeat, if only because it would stop the, like, hundreds of thousands of dollars you got to pay out every year to some guy or his family who are aggrieved because, because the guy gets tasered to death or, you know, whatever. So
you have, of course, now encouraged listeners in the text box. A couple of them popped up to think that tasing me for a bit is an excellent idea.
Here's the thing about that, Dawn.
That's not going to happen.
No, it's probably not going to happen with you, not as such. We have a listener of ours who is a part-time police officer right now, and he's going to be undergoing tasing training later on this year. And he said he's going to ask if, as a public service, if they could do some sort of a thing here on the show where he or somebody else from the department gets tased. And then, you know, he would come on and he would talk about it beforehand or whatever. So, and I told him, I said, that is a thing we would heartily approve of as a bit. So he's going to let us know about that. Well, just because it's, you know, the tasing thing fascinates me because it's like, you know, the thing about tasing is it's a confluence of two things that amuse me, which is science and technology. You know, that's the first half. And then the second half is sort of human incompetence, because the taser seems to be poorly designed. It's like a great idea badly executed, because none of them seem to have a standard voltage or wattage or whatever the hell it is, and nobody really seems to know quite how to use it, which is why you get in, you know, the man was tased 75 times before being arrested by police or whatever. So it's just, you know.
When I worked at the newspaper in Hooterville, one of my colleagues was this young girl right out of high school, and we had hired her on to be like junior reporter. And she took some kind of a public safety training course with the police department. And they did a taser demonstration and asked if anyone wanted to volunteer. And she did. And they tased her, mm-hmm. which was kind of
hilarious. And it's a dumb question. Did she say it hurt?
She said that it didn't hurt. She didn't actually feel physical pain. What she said, she was standing there, and then she was on the ground. That was basically it. It was like, okay, we're going to hit you with the taser now. Boom! And then she was just down. And then just laying there going, crap! And that was pretty much it.
I had somebody describe it to me as they said if you've ever chewed tinfoil, they said imagine if your entire body was a huge set of teeth and your entire body was just chewing tinfoil. And they said it doesn't hurt. It's just like it is a distinctly uncomfortable and disturbing sensation, as opposed to pepper spray. And this guy named Lyle, he actually has been pepper sprayed. He said it was the single worst. He said it was pain beyond his imagination.
I've been pepper sprayed before. It is not pleasant.
When were you pepper sprayed, Anna Griffin, from the Oregonian?
My deep, dark past.
That's the sort of thing for which I put on the confessional voice.
My husband's been pepper sprayed. He's talked about that as well.
Was it? I mean,
early in my journalism career, much like your story about your colleague who got tasered, it was a little police. Let's demonstrate how our different toys work. You want to be pepper sprayed? Sure, why not?
How long does it take to till it doesn't hurt anymore?
hours.
Really?
Yeah.
And were you, I mean, it's a dumb question, but I mean, you were blind after that, probably. I mean, did your eyes swell shut, or what is the deal?
I remember the weeping more than anything else, the uncontrollable weeping.
So what is it, so is it just... Is it just like a mist, or is it like actually like a liquid sort of? Because I always wonder how it is that it doesn't inadvertently like blow back on whoever it is that's spraying it.
Well, I think it does sometimes, which is part of the reason tasers have become more popular.
So
because I think pepper spray can backfire on you. So you know, I recall it's been a lot of years, but I recall it being sort of a heavier version of like a mister at a concert.
Right.
That you walk through.
It's exactly like one of the Lollapalooza cool-off
tents. Exactly.
If only.
Before we move to the next story, so with the cop, is it Sam Adams? Is it his call about whether the guy gets booted out or not?
A review board has recommended that he be fired, and now the police chief and his boss, the mayor, make the final decision.
Now, is that one of those things that, in your experience, the mayor typically goes along with what the police chief wants, just so as to not cause some sort of public ruckus? Or is it, I mean, there are prevailing winds, I would imagine, that one follows. How does that usually work?
There have been cases in the past where mayors and city commissioners who've been in charge of the police bureau have made different calls than the chief. It's very early in Mike Reese's tenure as police chief, and so it would be very surprising if he and Sam were not in accord on whatever decisions reach.
Well, does Sam Adams, I mean, everything must, even more so than with a typical politician, everything that guy does must be filtered through like 900 layers of, is this going to hurt me or help me at this point? Because he's, I mean...
Oh, yeah, and this is a pretty big one. I mean, it helps that, my opinion, it seems like a fairly cut and dried... You fire the guy, and it's hard to argue, shot an unarmed man in the back.
Right.
You killed him. But, you know, the Portland Police Association, the Union of Police Officers, is an exceptionally powerful political force in terms of the number of voters that they can turn out and their ability to get people to knock on doors and make phone calls for a candidate or against a candidate. So you have them on one side. They don't like their members getting fired. And then you have Portland's African-American community, which, I mean, Dawn talked about Jesse Jackson coming to town after Aaron Campbell was shot. They don't trust the police, and they don't trust the mayor. And so this is an opportunity for him politically to say, see, I am listening to what you say. So it's a fascinating little political call he has to make.
If you had, just in your journalistic opinion, if you had to lay money right now?
I think he fires him.
All right. Here's Dawn Taylor at the news desk.
Let's do that monkey watch.
I hate you. I hate you more than I've ever hated anyone. Here's the thing. So we do various watches on the program that have theme songs associated with them. And when we got fired at KUFO, sort of in a fit of pique, I didn't back up a lot of my files. And so some of my files I have recovered since then. In fact, almost all of them. The only one that I've not been able to find is the theme to the monkey watch, which is, I think it was the Donna Reed theme, but then the sounds of an angry attacking chimp over the top of it. And Tim Riley made it. And so I don't have access to it. And so I said last hour, I believe, that if by the time we got to that story, I had not been able to edit one together and create one, that I would, in fact, just make monkey noises at the beginning of the story.
You know, my children and I make monkey noises all the time. So if you need help, let me know.
No, this is a shame that I should bear on my own. I don't want you to have to carry that weight. It's, here's your, Is this because I was making fun of the way your femur looked? Is this some sort
no,
of a...
it's just that kind of a day.
All right. And now, here's your monkey watch for Thursday. I don't know what a monkey... I don't know
That's
how to...
really weak. Really weak.
That was terrible.
Sons of bitches. I'm doing the best I can.
Could you show them what a monkey sounds like?
Do you want a ferocious monkey? Do you want a...
Sure, because there's ferocious monkeys in this story.
Okay.
There we go.
I was unnerved just now. It was like I was in the Congo.
This is actually more of an ape watch, but there we go.
All right.
The vineyards and houses of one of South Africa's poshest suburbs are under siege by groups of marauding Cape baboons who feast on Sauvignon Blanc grapes fermenting in the sun and terrorize locals. Each day, dozens of Cape baboons gather to strip the vines, the Sauvignon Blanc grapes.
Are these baboons
grapes
in a Tennessee Williams play?
They're South African, so no. The Sauvignon Blanc grapes are a particular favorite before heading into the mountains to sleep. A few who sample fallen fruit that is fermented in the sun just pass out and don't make it home. They're not just eating our grapes. They're raiding our kitchens and ripping the thatch off the roofs. They're becoming increasingly bold and destructive, said Jean Nod, general manager of the vineyard, which is celebrating its 325th birthday this year. Guards banging sticks and waving plastic snakes have been deployed with only limited success, and not even a blast of a vuvuzela seems to frighten them. Before laws afforded baboons a protected status a decade ago, troublesome animals were regularly killed or maimed by homeowners and farmers. Now around 20 full-time baboon monitors are employed to protect them and guide them away from residential areas. It has proved impossible. Last week, a 12-year-old boy was left traumatized after confronting a troop who broke into his family home.
I don't think you can really guide wild animals. I think that's sort of like a hinting at your dog he shouldn't wet on the carpet sort of a thing.
Well, the 12-year-old boy confronted the baboons who had broken into his home. He heard noises from the kitchen, went to investigate, found them ransacking cupboards. When he fled upstairs to find his babysitter, three male baboons gave chase, surrounded him as he made a tearful phone call to his mother, and pelted him with fruit.
I'm sorry. I know that I was waiting for something much worse there when you said traumatized. It was like a round-robin fruiting that happened to him.
To be fair, chickens, geese, peacocks, and even someone's Great Dane have been killed in recent weeks by the marauding baboons. The males have huge and terrifying canine teeth. Roof tiles, electric fences, orchards, and vegetable gardens have been trashed. A homeowner complained, "Lunch parties in the garden are now just impossible. It's so unrelaxing. Rather than chatting over our meal, we're looking over our shoulders and bolting the food as quickly as we can it is stolen by baboons."
This is one of those things where I can't figure out if this is a disproportionate complaint or not, because on the one hand, if the largest issue in your life is that your lunch parties are being disrupted, I immediately have no sympathy for you whatsoever. But on the other hand, there is something to be said for a bunch of gigantic baboons to be rushing into your home and destroying your possessions, and I would imagine threatening you with large razor-sharp teeth.
I have an image of a monkey dressed for tea time, don't you?
So, you know, with a monocle? With a monocle
a
and then
like a, and demanding biscuits.
And a severed head in the other hand.
Pardon me, do you have any Sauvignon Blanc grapes?
Do you have scones? No scones! And then off comes the face.
Well, wildlife authorities have begun collaring baboons identified as troublesome and imposed a strict three-strikes policy, whereby animals which repeatedly break into homes are humanely destroyed.
Do you suppose the animals are told this? Is this like a stern warning that they're given? Is like something go in their permanent record?
They must explain it to them somehow.
You there. Mooney sees you a third time. It's going to be the clink for you. And then they just, and then they're shooed back out into the... All right. Well, there you go. This is, again, as I should note, I always do, in man versus nature stories, when it comes to me and my immediate, the vicinity, and I guess maybe in the overall, I suppose that I guess I ultimately root for man, because that's, you know, I guess that's my team, and so, you know, what are you going to do? But in situations like this, especially where it's far removed from my own circumstance, I mean, I have sort of an ill-concealed glee whenever nature just goes on the rampage against people.
It's the lunch party comment that turns it.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, you know, it's the best story we ever had, and I wish that I had kept it. It's one of those things that we read, then I set it aside, and it's gone somewhere. And there were a couple, like, it wasn't video, but there were some sort of still... It was like the Mount St. Helens thing, where there was a series of still photographs showing the event unfolding. And it was in Mexico City, I believe, and there was a street performer, and he was him and like some not spider monkeys, but like rhesus monkeys or something, and he had quote trained them, and by trained I mean like hit with a stick until they did what he told them, and they were doing like sort of low rent like circus tricks, basically. Like he had one that like it didn't juggle, but it like threw stuff around, and like one would like balance on a unicycle or something, and he would do this for onlookers who would toss money into his hat, and if the monkeys didn't do the trick appropriately, he would give them a big whacking with a stick. And one day, the monkeys, I think they just had some sort of like a, you know, some sort of an ad hoc, you know, like a secret unionization meeting where they're like, enough with the stick whacking. Like, we are done with that. Today, that stops. And the guy went to whack one of the monkeys with this, and the monkey just took the stick from him and just started beating the guy in the face. And then Velociraptor style, like two of the others, like came from the sides and leapt onto him and began pulling his hair and punching him. And the best part is that the onlookers, I presume, were horrified, but also realized that this is a thing newspapers would pay money to have a visual record of, and just being in snapping photos. So you and I really wish you could see it, because, and everybody at home will have to sort of imagine, you know, how this looks. But it was a great sort of picture one, you know, monkey on a unicycle. Picture two, guy raising a stick to hit the monkey. Picture three, monkey grabbing the stick, man with horrified look on his face. Picture five, man cowering on the ground while he is besieged by monkeys, punching him repeatedly and, you know, beating his ass. it was just, and I remember seeing that, and I just sort of set the story aside, and I had just the warmest glow inside, and I faced the rest of the day with an extra spring in my step, feeling good about the way this planet works.
I just love coming on a show where you can describe something as velociraptor-like,
yeah,
and everyone knows exactly what you're talking about.
Trust me, this is here's the thing, Anna Griffin from the Oregonian. You've been on Outlook Portland like 3, 4, 5 times. You and Steve Dean's been on maybe once or twice.
Once,
I think it might have been once, and then I don't know if he refused to come back, but I got the feeling that it would take a special event to convince him to return. Not that he's not a lovable guy, but it's...
He gave you the look a few times to let you know that he was not sure what was going on, but he was not pleased with it.
He's a sort of lovable curmudgeon, but you realize that the veil of him, you know, the veil of newsprint is there for a reason. So he writes the thing, the newspaper conveys the thing, you read the thing. That is, I think, a necessary... It's sort of a moat between you and the actual curmudgeon-like person. Now, which, again, I find endearing. But I also understand when someone does not find me as charming as I find myself. Anyway, having done Outlook Portland, you're not here, so you are really among your people. Because, and I mean this in the best possible way, you're just a big nerd in the same way that we are.
By the way, that was the end of the Monkey Watch, and you have to close out the Monkey Watch by doing another monkey sound. Because we always have the ending.
Is that a bird?
I don't know what it is. I don't know what a monkey sounds like, really. All I know is the thing that we had in the Monkey Watch before, and that was just a series of high-pitched sort of squeaks.
Could you broadcast from the zoo one day for a little research?
It's entirely possible. The world is our oyster. We are the law, Anna Griffin. We can broadcast anywhere we want. So just before we progress here, and we have to try to get away with a few things because we're running sort of dangerously behind, I will, take this opportunity to say that if you find it at all amusing when I make sort of ill-conceived primate noises beyond the microphone, you can thank, among other folks, Michael Beatty. He is the proprietor of The Cleaning Solution. Say, Mom, has your home been besieged by baboons trying to get that rug clean before hubby comes home? Call The Cleaning Solution at 971-533-3211. 971-533-3211. Here's what we're going to do one of these days. We'll have Michael Beatty on, and we're going to ask him sort of some of his experiences, because I think I may be wrong about this. I think he did, in fact, tell me at one point. I could just be making this up. I think he did tell me at one point that he had to go clean a house where there had been some sort of unpleasantness. There's something... I believe something criminal had happened, and he got called into clinic. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think I am. But in any event, you know, if you had a house that was maybe formerly nice, and then you had the idea of getting, a dog, say, or let's say a cat, because cats have this... Or a monkey. Gila monster, whatever it is. Cats will do this thing sometimes. When dogs make a mess, it's kind of out in the open at least. You can sort of see it and you recognize it. You know, Spot has done something bad and you gotta go get the scrubber and take it out of the rug. Cats will occasionally have this thing where they'll find a squirrel or something outside that maybe they caught, or maybe it was just like sitting around somewhere in a shrub. And they just dragged it in and they left it behind a couch. And then, by the time you find it, there's just a whole lot of filth back there that needs to be cleaned up. And you don't want to be doing that yourself. So the point is, you live in America. You need no longer sully your hands with dirt. You can pay people to do that for you. They say there's an app for that. There's a guy for that. His name is Michael Beatty. His company is The Cleaning Solution. He will come clean your home, your carpet, upholstery, stone, marble tile, anything your feet might touch, anything your dog might despoil. How is it that spoil and despoil can mean the same thing? Well, it doesn't really matter. Point is, he can be reached at 971, and bone and debone mean the same thing. All right, stop now. 971-533-3211 is his phone number. 971-533-3211. He is a proud sponsor of the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Please tell him you heard about it. Here he does residential and commercial work. Michael Beatty of The Cleaning Solution. Hear me hit the end of the song like that? That's how you know you're a pro, Don. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Don't forget, coming up tomorrow, we're going to do actually two installments of the show. We're going to actually do part one and part two. Tomorrow we'll do our regular show from 1 to 3 at 4:45-ish. I'll send a sort of Twitter update as we get closer to this. Tomorrow afternoon, though, we have a supplementary edition of the Rick Emerson Show. We're going to be interviewing Mr. Dave Mustaine from Megadeth. That'll be tomorrow afternoon. That'll be replayed next week. Next week also, sci-fi fantasy author Terry Brooks, the Rick Emerson Show. So be listening for that. That's the kind of caliber of guest we get here. You can tell Mr. Steve Dean Dave Mustaine isn't coming to talk to him. It's right here.
That is Velociraptor-like.
What is coming up in the Oregonian in the immediate future, Anna Griffin?
We'll be writing about TriMet. We'll be writing about the gubernatorial candidates, John Kitzhaber and Chris Dudley. Still have not decided if and when they might actually debate.
Is that, I mean, don't they have to? Isn't that a thing where they are required to?
No. They don't have to. I mean,
if they just
in
made
terms of the moral law, are they required to? Yes, of course they are. But in terms of are they actually legally required to? No.
They could just sort of have an agreement among themselves that they're not going to do that?
Well, what the situation right now is that both campaigns have thrown out dates and times that they are willing to debate. They're just completely different.
Is it one of those, the thing where one guy wants four debates and one guy wants one debate and one guy wants a town hall and one guy wants a moderator and no town hall?
Exactly.
All right. You wrote a piece about the restoration of the Hung Far Low sign.
I did.
First of all, are there, and I've lived here for like 12 years, so I don't know this. It makes me a bad Portlander. Are there two Hung Far Low locations, or is it just one? Or is it one that moved to somewhere else?
They were in Old Town.
Okay.
Old Town Chinatown, right. Let's be specific. And I think 2004, 2005, they moved out, like many of the original Asian restaurants in Old Town moved out to 82nd Avenue.
And is it when they restored the sign, is it, because it's not, I can't imagine that thing possibly being classed as like an actual historic, like part of Portland, but it is, but there's sort of a, you know, there's like official historic things, and then there are things that are just sort of, you know, the people's historic, you know, buildings or locations like that Pagoda restaurant, which they knocked down in the dead of night, those bastards, you know what I'm talking about, the Pagoda that was at 39th and Sandy?
Yeah.
So, because there was this whole Save the Pagoda thing where people were sort of, they were going to have, because they put a bank there, I think is what went up. And so there was this whole movement to try to save the Pagoda restaurant, and they were going to try to get it moved somewhere else, or they were going to have it, maybe set just off to the side.
They were
going to
make it part of a bus stop.
Is that where they're going
to? Yeah, they were going to take the Pagoda and put it on top of the bus stop. But what they found out was the Pagoda was actually a piece of crap. It was like aluminum and was falling apart, and there was really no way to save it.
Is that the thing? Because they had all these protests planned, and then like the night before the protests were going to, you almost have to admire this like the perverse brilliance of it. The night before the protests were going to begin, like some guys just showed up with a dump truck and a backhoe and just went and kicked it into a truck and just hauled it away. And it was just sort of gone the next day.
Well, it's a beautiful key bank now.
Well, I know.
So what's going on with the Hung Far Low sign anyway? Is it up?
Well, there was a huge...
They're putting it someplace. Because it is a historical thing.
It's one of those
Portland
sort of key
landmark.
Portland weird, quirky, yeah. You're drunk in the middle of the night, you go hang out at the bar at Hung Far Low and
become drunker.
And you become, become much drunker, maybe a little sick if you eat the food. Restaurant moves out to 82nd Avenue when the building just sort of sits vacant for a while. When the guys responsible for Ping, the very fine Thai restaurant out on Division, go in there, or the guys Pok Pok go in to create Ping in Old Town, which is their new restaurant, one of the parts of their lease agreement was that they would replace the roof. And they go up to replace the roof and discovered that the metal bars holding the sign in place were not doing a very good job of holding the bars in place. And so this 2,000-pound sign was basically being held up by rust.
So it was just a matter of time until...
it fell on someone,
the wind blew the wrong way.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Right. And so the sign comes down, and there's rust everywhere. There were holes in the original sign. There used to be neon tubes. Mm-hmm. Water had gotten in the holes, so the entire thing was rusted out. But there was a great hue and cry that
this
the Hung Far
Low
sign is part of Portland, and so they raised almost $70,000 to save it.
See, and that's what I realize that is really what's great about Portland is that, not that cities can't have sort of traditional style historic buildings or artifacts or whatever, it's like some building from 1814 where somebody stopped to use the bathroom on his way to somewhere more important or whatever. But I like the fact that here we latch on to things that other that traditionally speaking would be viewed as kind of tacky, or kind of cheesy or whatever. It's like there's that whole thing. I always confuse it with Atomic Arts Northway. It's not the Atomic Arts Theater Group. Is it the Atomic Society? I believe they're called the Atomic Society of Portland. And they are, you know, they're all about that sort of 50s, 60s kind of Mad Men era neon art, especially neon, like, hotel signs, like the Alibi. There's that whole section, like, on the interstate area where there's all of those neon signs, and that group actually works to preserve a lot of those. And whenever one of those buildings is in danger of being knocked down, they try to save the neon signs, which I sort of, you know, and I really like that. That's the same, that is kind of like the same group of folks that really comes to the defense of Memorial Coliseum.
Yes.
Because there's, you know, there's been a whole bunch of discussion about that thing, which is basically just a big box. Yeah. And I don't even know, but that is officially, has that officially been designated as, like, a historic location?
Yes.
So that's the end of that particular story. That is sort of done.
You could still tear it down. It would take a lot of work and legal challenges to tear it down.
I had an architect one time, actually, who was very, really, like, incensed about that whole, the get rid of the Memorial Coliseum movement. And he sat and explained to me why it was beautiful and great from an architectural point of view. And I can't really remember a whole lot of it now, but I remember at the end of the argument, I was thoroughly, maybe it was just his tone of voice and the fact that he said it really confidently, but I was totally convinced at the end of that. I was absolutely brought around.
They get very angry, the architects.
That
we lay people do not understand why the giant glass boxes, cool.
Yeah, they're a passionate people. Let's go back to the news desk. We'll do this, and then we will, at that point, probably judge whether or not we're going to have time to do the top five. We may or may not.
Okay.
I don't know if this is news to anyone but you and I, but Cheryl just sent me a link. We missed the soft opening today, apparently, but we're getting a new cafe and espresso place right across the street in the Ford building.
I had no idea.
Ford Food and Drink, the second restaurant from Detour Cafe owners, Rebecca Doggett and Scott Crumbine.
When you say we missed the soft opening, do you mean we missed free food? Because that's really
apparently
the only
we
way
missed
that
free
that would concern
coffee.
Me.
Eater, the PDX Eater says that there will also be free coffee available tomorrow, but
okay.
I don't know. I don't know if it will or not.
Here is Don Taylor at the news desk.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
I think we should do this penis watch because I've been holding on to this for a couple of days.
So to speak. Here's your penis watch for, what is this? This is Thursday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Take a look at my enormous penis. And my troubles start a-melting away. Bow, bow, bow. I take a look at my enormous penis. And everything is going my way.
Bow, bow, bow. At the news desk, it's Don Taylor with your penis watch for Thursday.
1 in 10 British men are unable to see their own penis because their protruding bellies are in the way, new research has found.
I did not expect that to be what this was about. Just for those who are maybe, and by those I mean Anna Griffin, who are maybe unfamiliar with the history of the Rick Emerson Show and our various watches and types of news. You heard a cannibal watch, I think, the last time you were here.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
There's some that we've retired over the years. We used to have a Britney watch that there's really not much call for anymore. The Jackson watch, we don't really do a whole lot these days. The penis watch has a long and storied history on the Rick Emerson Show, usually about something awful happening to somebody's penis, which then ends with the sort of unconvincing explanation that he was just vacuuming in the nude.
I'm just concerned I'm going to be humming the penis song when I help my son get in his pajamas tonight.
Well, you know, boys have to learn about the facts of life at some point, and what better entree to that? I didn't really expect this to start that way. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Don.
2,000 men took part in the study conducted by weight management specialists Later Life, which indicated that 43% hadn't seen their penis in the last 2 years without the aid of a mirror or adjusting their body shape, while 16% couldn't remember the last time they saw their own penis. These figures suggest that, proportionally, 2.5 million British men are too fat to see their own penis. The survey also discovered the reasons behind such poor health in some of the participants, with alcohol consumption proving a problem. 30% of the men admitted to drinking alcohol 3 times a week, and 1 in 10 stated they booze daily. But what's even more worrying is the revelation that it could take drastic circumstances to make a lot of men surveyed do something about their weight. Over half claimed that they would lose weight if they were constantly embarrassed about their appearance. Others said health risks, inability to perform in bed, and man boobs would make them think twice about their lifestyle choices.
I have so many questions about this. First of all, I mean, okay. If they, and I'm assuming that means it, like in any sort of position, like reclining in a chair or standing,
your
belly
is just so big you can't see your penis.
I'm sorry, I apologize. There's no way for me to avoid this. I have to actually stand up now.
You're a slender man.
I'm not saying it's a problem with me, Don. For any number of reasons, I don't face this issue. But I'm trying to figure out exactly how, in other words, like how big your gut would have to be, because that's just sort of like, I mean, that's sizable. I mean, you'd have to be a sort of... But I guess that is a thing where...
Probably on average, your stomach would have to stick out about, say, 9 inches.
Well, yeah, and because certain sections of your body just don't. It's not like you know, as one gains weight, sometimes, if for example, if you are a woman, if you gain weight in general, your bosoms will become larger. That's not really the case with if you're a guy. Like, it's not like you like the store becomes bigger somehow. It just it's
actually,
the same size.
And this is interesting because I did read this once. Your penis technically becomes smaller the more you gain weight because
is that perceptually smaller or actually smaller?
Well, your penis itself is a certain size.
Your penis yourself. Don Taylor's Guide to Health.
If you gain weight, if you gain, say, another half inch to an inch of actual body fat,
right,
like in your pelvic region, that is coming up around your penis. So
it's sort of being
sort of absorbed into your body.
So it's like your penis. I cannot, even by this show's standards, this is. We're saying the word penis a lot today. So then it's sort of like your penis is sinking into sort of a fleshy quicksand if you gain weight, because it's sort of being, it's gradually being enveloped.
Right.
I've rarely been so happy to be a lesbian as right at this moment.
Zing. I don't really know that we can, unless there's really a punchline coming up, we should go out on that, Dawn, because I don't think that can be topped.
Why not? I had a quote from a TV doctor about this, but yeah.
No, it's, no. Yeah. He's no Anna Griffin. All right, we're going to end, there's your penis watch. And I guess that's just sort of a theoretical penis watch at this point. It makes you wonder, like, if you're a guy who can't see your penis,
yeah.
First of all, I wonder if it's like as you slowly gain weight, because men, men have a special relationship with that area of their body and whatnot, because we're all children. But I mean, as a guy is slowly gaining weight, I wonder if it's sort of like when you see an especially beautiful sunset finally sinking over the horizon. And you say, farewell to you and Godspeed. And then it's gone and you can't see it. And you're left with the memories.
Or if you have that moment where you think to yourself, I saw more of that last month.
It seems like there used to be something. I'm missing something. Honey, are my shoelaces different? There's something going on here. I can't quite tell. Are my toenails longer? And then here's the other thing, because guys are just like so, and I know we've ended it, but I'm just fascinated by this, because guys are just so obsessed with and fascinated by their own member in any number of ways, that you wonder if occasionally is there a thing where like a hand mirror comes out from time to time just to make sure that all is sort of well, to make sure that it hasn't been spirited away by gypsies in the middle of the night or something. I mean, you would think that every now and again. I mean, I feel like we're just developing into being like a Fanny Flagg novel or something here, but I feel like every now and again you'd want to get one of those little mirrors the bank used to give out, and you just sort of
in case.
That's what I'm saying, just because you never know.
Something could be going on down there.
You know, I should actually say that Shel Silverstein has a, he wrote poems for adults as well as for children, and he didn't work blue or anything, but he had adults that use a little bit of salty language, and he did in fact have, Shel Silverstein wrote a poem that he made into a song, and it was called The Dieting Song. And the dieting song, which talked about how bad it was to diet and how it was just a living torment and misery and whatever, he does reveal at one point of the song that the motivation for dieting came because he could no longer see his manhood. It was no longer visible to him. So anyway, so this is maybe a more widespread problem, especially in Britain.
Apparently so.
I'm just glad that that's not a thing that we're leading the world in, because
for a change.
Well, Don and I were talking about this the other day, that it's like that there was that in Freakonomics, I believe it was, or the second Freakonomics book, they talked about the rate of pregnancy and spread of certain sexually transmitted diseases in India, and they couldn't, which is. Relatively speaking, as an educated country in terms of birth control, contraceptive availability, as contrasted with a lot of other countries that have problems like that, and they couldn't figure out why. And they eventually deduced, condom manufacturers deduced that they were, and I swear to God this is true, that they were making condoms that were too large because Indian men were on average smaller than the average man in that regard. And it's like, that's the sort of thing you don't really want quantified and then put into a book that will sell 5 million copies everywhere. You know what I mean? So it is with British men and their penis. right. Yet again, I am sort of putting a message from one of our fine advertisers adjacent to something awkward or horrible on the program, so Rick Emerson regrets the error. I keep saying it's not going to happen again, but I think we know by now that that's just a lie. That's just one big deception. Castalia Language Center is a small private school in downtown Portland that offers Spanish language classes for adults. Anna Griffin from the Oregonian, do you speak Spanish?
No.
Do you wish you spoke Spanish? Do you regret not learning Spanish?
I do. Both my kids are learning Spanish, and soon they will be able to speak a language I do not.
Are they now? Are they learning it in school?
There.
Is it a thing? If I may ask this, how old are your kids?
Almost 4 and 7.
Really? And so now is this? Now I am actually fascinated by this. And I don't mean to pry, but I mean, do they go to like a public school or private school or just
my very generous in-laws pay for them to go to private school.
So is that a thing that they or you opted to take, or is it just a thing they teach as a matter of the regular course?
It's a language immersion school.
That's we talk about this all the time. That it's, I always tell people that, you know, look, maybe you feel like you don't need to speak Spanish, but certainly your kids will. But the time your kids are growing up, they're going to have to learn it. And depending on where you live in the States, you got to learn it now because it's the de facto primary language in a lot of communities, and certainly it is the de facto secondary language in almost all communities in this country.
Absolutely. Well, and it's like everything else. You go to any other country and everybody you run into speaks English in addition to their native language. So why are we so arrogant or stupid to think that we don't need to speak something else?
That's the thing. And just, I mean, and really just in practical terms, you know, depending on where you're going to be conducting business, you know, it's a thing. It is one of the emerging languages of the 20th and 21st century. So if you do not speak Spanish, if like a lot of people, maybe you took it for a year or two in high school, but then you got on the other side of that and you realize you can't actually speak it, then what you ought to be doing is go to PortlandSpanish.com. That's the website, PortlandSpanish.com. Clara Grebel, who runs the school, she's from Argentina, and she now runs Castalia Language Center, which is downtown, and they specialize just in adults. So it's, because kids especially now are learning it so often in school, and kids and adults learn languages very differently. Kids can really just soak up a language, like, seemingly overnight. They can just begin to, I mean, your kids are probably doing that, where they got, and they can just, you know, they can speak it.
They're speaking in Spanish, or they're speaking in tongues, so.
And you get to be like 8 or 9 or 10 years of age. You reach, what the Catholic Church calls the age of reason, and your brain just starts to slow down a bit in the language center, and so you just don't learn it as quickly. So these classes are structured solely for adults, and they are limited to 8 students, which means that you are going to be able to learn in the way that everybody else in class is learning, at the same rate, in the same way, and you're going to get pretty much individual attention. It's a comfortable and relaxed environment, and of course they are proud sponsors of the Rick Emerson Show and the Emerson News Network. So that right there is reason enough for you to give them your loyalty. They can be, they can be found out more about, and that's not only tortured syntax, but then I still end the sentence with a preposition. You can find out more about them at PortlandSpanish.com. Please tell me you heard about it here. PortlandSpanish.com is where you contact Castalia Language Center. All right. I believe I heard the sounds of Greg and Sarah entering the green room, so we will probably put a pin in the top 5 and do that for tomorrow.
Anyway, grasas hombres penes no puede considerarse.
Is this something about my penis?
Fat men's penises cannot be seen.
See how I just sussed that out from your inflection alone? You're a natural, Don Taylor. Anna Griffin from the Oregonian, you mentioned that you've got the TriMet coverage coming up. Is there anything else of note maybe on the horizon in the next weeks or months that people should be looking
week,
for?
Next week, I'll be writing about the going back to school, what it's like going back to school. If you're not going back to school because you just got laid off. The Centennial School District out in Gresham, one of a number of districts in Oregon that has had to cut its librarians. And so I have a profile of a former elementary school librarian there.
They had to lay off librarians?
They did.
All right, that is the unkindest cut of all. I have an affinity for libraries and librarians, just because they're sort of, I think like a lot of boys who grew up nerdy, I hold librarians in this sort of, they occupy this rarefied space in the culture because they are sort of like the gatekeepers of all knowledge. It's, you know, they're sort of there to keep the barbarians, from storming the gate. They are the keepers of the intellect.
Well, it's the philosophical question is what is the purpose of the public schools? You know, we've cut and cut and cut so that these days the purpose of the public schools tends to be training kids to take standardized tests.
Well, and the more cynical view, which is that it's that, and that I long ago sort of came to the conclusion that schools are basically just there to keep your kids off the street until they're 18 because the state doesn't, because the longer a kid can stay in school, the longer he's not going to be out there running around with, you know, zip guns, hopped up on goofballs, or whatever it is the kids do. But, you know, that is the thing. If the state can make sure they're there for 18 years, that's 18 years that the state doesn't have to worry about taking care of them out in some, you know, some outside social realm. And it becomes a, you know, it becomes a whole thing of social conditioning. So we'll talk, I guess, maybe more about that the next time you are here.
I'm depressed now. Yes, thank you.
I like to end the show on sort of a kind of a note. All right, then. The Rick Emerson Show is now ending. That is the most anticlimactic. I should have ended the show 10 minutes ago. The end of the penis watch.
Should we just talk about penises again? Because
it's probably too soon for that. Now you can't overdose on that because then it just then it's no longer. Then it won't be special the next time you come here. You can read or print in the Oregonian online at OregonLive.com. Quickly, what is your favorite season of Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
Graduation.
Is that your favorite episode, hands down?
The season with the mayor and, yeah.
Now, is that your favorite episode, actually?
No, the musical is my favorite episode.
All right. Dawn Taylor, what is your favorite episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
Probably Hush.
Okay, see, which is also great. I was going to say, actually, the two of my favorite episodes are I love the graduation, the finale, which is awesome, especially for the moment where the mayor goes, oh, gosh, before he blows up.
Be home before dawn.
I also love the Dawn and her shiny, shiny hair. I actually got a little bit unpleasant flashback there. My favorite, and I'm asking you this for no particular reason, is only because every time you're on Outlook Portland, we always devolve into talking about either The Wire or Buffy for some reason. And I realized that we'd never actually done that here. So I think every time you come on the show, I'm just going to throw out like a nerd survey question at the end.
We can't actually quote The Wire.
No.
You don't like the cursing.
I don't like to work blue. You know, my favorite episode of Buffy is the prom. It is the prom episode. So much so that I actually, because I really can't be embarrassed in many ways. My shame actually just doesn't even exist. I actually have a figurine of Buffy at home where she is holding the golden parasol, aww, the class protector award that I think Jonathan or whatever gave her. So
I have the Once More with Feeling poster. That I actually bought on eBay from somebody. It was like they put them in bus thingies and stuff like that in Los Angeles when the show came out. And it's this big, elaborate. It's huge. It's enormous. I have it actually framed in my office.
That's fantastic.
My daughter refers to the musical disc as princess music because that's how we convinced her to let us play in the car.
Oh, because if she thought it was, so you had to sort of slip it into the guise of
being. It's
a story
about a princess, and she's fighting, you know, she's fighting the evil bad guys.
The speaking of which, and then I swear to God, we'll end the show here in like 5 seconds. You know what just slipped my brain until just now is that Tom Lenk, I think, has already been here and done his thing and left. That
we
bastard, and he never called us.
He was supposed to come here.
We did a phone interview with him. But the phone interview, as we were conducting the interview, he was walking around his house gathering up his stuff to put into a duffel bag because he was going to the gym. And then he was in the car on the phone, and it sounded for all the world like he was about to wrap himself around a telephone pole. He sounded like the world's worst driver. And I did not want to be like... a talk show host captured a grisly moment on his broadcast Thursday when actor Tom Lenk was killed. Here's the audio. So I finally just said, like, we have to end this call. Like, you got to come see us when you come to town. And I believe he, in fact, promised to do so. And
he
failed to live up to that promise. And he is now my sworn enemy, Tom Lenk. You'll be found and dealt with appropriately. Have no doubt about that. Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. You can be read and printed in The Oregonian online at OregonLive.com. Join us tomorrow when our special guests will include Dave Mustaine from Megadeth. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network. At the news desk is Dawn Taylor. Advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill. Executive producer Bruce Agler. And our chief of staff is Cheryl Kanakoa. After a brief musical interlude, we'll have an encore edition of today's Legion of News episode, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. In the meantime, thank you for listening. It is Thursday, September 2nd, 2010, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, my name is Rick Emerson. Thank you all for listening. See y'all tomorrow. Be safe. Bye now.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep is now concluded. Thanks for listening.